Be seated. Right. Welcome back. We are still on 0907 and Mr. Tony Klauber is our next speaker.
Thank you for allowing me to address the court, and I guess what I'm really asking for the Supreme Court.
Just one moment.
Yes, ma'am.
You filed a written statement, and it's under our tab 24. Thank you.
Thank you.
Go ahead.
That's a way for the Supreme Court to allow people to get their name cleared off the CCAP. That's, I guess, what I'm after. And I won't go into a lot of the details because you have it written in front of you, but a temporary restraining order was given to me by a deputy, Brown County deputy officer, and it was a harassment complaint filled by some dishonest comments. It was completed by some comments from our neighbors, which, of course, I believe are dishonest. I can't prove that in front of you today, but obviously I wouldn't be here if I didn't believe it was dishonest. And I'm going to skip over the details of those unless you ask me about those because I know you're limited for time. But here I would use evidence of why the complaint wasn't legitimate. I appeared at the Brown County Courthouse to answer the harassment complaint. The officer of the court listened and questioned the neighbors regarding their issues in the harassment complaint, and then the officer of the court denied the harassment without any written or oral testimony from me. I never had to say a word, never had to present anything. The court officer stated the complaint was without merit and the neighbors brought no proof that the allegations were true. And the case was closed. And that's what it says in CCAP, the case is closed. It doesn't say dismissed. It doesn't say innocent. It doesn't say anything. It just says closed. And it still says harassment complaint. The case is not closed for my family and me. I never realized my name would be forever on a CCAP system. I naively believed that since the case was dismissive, no longer be in the system, and I was obviously wrong. I work as a district administrator for the School District of Denmark. We use CCAP. I think there is value in CCAP. I've seen the other side of it now. And I don't think if I applied for another position in the school in Wisconsin right now that I may not even get an interview if they go on CCAP and see an harassment complaint was filed against me and so recently. Even though it has no merit, it was thrown out because it's on that system. Because of the position I hold, it's a public position.
Have you taken any efforts like going to see the circuit court judge and seeing if the entry can be amended? Instead of just saying closed, saying dismissed?
I didn't go to the circuit court because I didn't know that was direction. I have called the Attorney General's office of the state of Wisconsin trying, even before I went to court, saying, why is my name on there? This was just filed. How come I'm in this court system? So that's I didn't know the routes.
Mm-hmm. Okay, thank
okay?
you.
Mm-hmm. And I still don't exactly know the route to get my name off, and that's why I'm here. Even though the case is closed and there was no evidence of me doing anything wrong, as I've explained, the employer may still believe there was something to that situation, and I may not get an interview. That's why I think it does harm. I can't understand why a person's name who was found not to be at fault should not have the option of having their name removed from the CCAP system some way. So I'm asking the court respectively to provide some avenue for individuals cleared of wrongdoing to remove their names from the system. And in closing, unless there's a question, I'll just say what happened to me and my family could happen to anybody in this courtroom, to the justices I'm looking at right now. You do something, some clerk says you harassed me, they file it, it gets filed, your name's forever in the system. And it can be ridiculous and ludicrous allegation, but if it gets signed and you're on there, it's on forever. There has to be a way to get it off, and it's nobody's business. It's not the press's business of this. It's nobody's business. It was, and so I'm asking you, find a way out for us, because we don't know, and I know there's many other stories. We don't know how to get out of this system.
Can I ask you a question?
Yes, sir.
Did you appear in front of a circuit judge, or was it a court commissioner?
I think, Your Honor, it was a court commissioner.
And have you ever looked at the paper record in the clerk's office?
No.
I would suggest that you do that. It may be that the minutes that were taken and should have been taken with the hearing before the commissioner would say something other than closed, like the petition was denied, and that might give you a basis to do something. So I would suggest that you go into the clerk's office in Brown County, that you ask the clerk to see the file, and that you see what the minutes show in regard to the action taken by the commissioner. I know that's not the whole ball game here, but I'd suggest you take that step, sir.
I appreciate that. I will do that.
Are there any other questions? Well, thank you very much, Mr. Paskey. Mr. Klauboff. Steve Paskey.
Good afternoon, Chief Justice, Associate Justices. Thank you for this opportunity to address you this morning, or I'm sorry, this afternoon. Thought it would be this morning. Thankful for the opportunity, nevertheless. As we've come to understand, this is a very complicated issue with many facets, but I would like to focus specifically as it relates to cases where the accused is acquitted or the charges are dismissed. According to West Encyclopedia of American Law, double jeopardy is defined as a second prosecution for the same offense after acquittal or conviction, or multiple punishments for the same offense. And as this esteemed body knows, this is prohibited by the Fifth Amendment to the United States Constitution. In my opinion, making available via CCAP, WCCA, whatever we want to refer to it as, information regarding cases where the accused has been acquitted or where the charges have been dismissed is in clear violation of our Fifth Amendment rights. It is my goal to support this opinion with the following information. Writing in Reflect and Relate, an Introduction to Interpersonal Communication, the author, Stephen McCormick, writes, "We also place emphasis on the negative information we learn about others, a pattern known as the negativity effect. Across cultures, people perceive negative information as more informative about someone's true character than positive information. People tend to believe that positive events, information, and personal characteristics are more commonplace than negative events, information, and characteristics. So when we learn something negative about another person, we see it as unusual. Consequently, we judge that information as more truly representative of a person's character than positive information." McCormick continues, "A final way we form impressions is to perceptually categorize people into a social group and then evaluate them based on information we have in our mental schemata related to this group. This is otherwise known as stereotyping." McCormick mentions that stereotyping is also impossible to avoid. Researchers have documented that categorizing people in terms of their social groups, group affiliations, is the most common way we form impressions about others. Studies show that people are predisposed to believing negative information about a person and stereotyping them based on negative information. Information such as potential employers, landlords, and whomever has nefarious desires might find on CCAP. As the press is concerned regarding this petition before the court, another author, Susan Dente Ross, writes in Images That Injure, "Good journalists try to tell both sides or even many sides of a story. It is my opinion that in voicing their opposition to this position, the press is telling only their side of the story for self-serving purposes. Please consider," Ross also writes, "through selection, emphasis, and omission, journalists direct the attention of their audience toward the aspects of daily life that consistently warrant and do not warrant consideration. The selective attention of the media helps set the agenda for public discussion of social issues. No amount of goodwill or effort can eliminate the fact that what we see depends on who we are and where we look." The Wisconsin Freedom of Information Council holds the position that unfettered access to information on CCAP is more important than what I maintain is a person's constitutional right against double jeopardy, as well as the most basic tenet of freedom in this country, an unalienable right to life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. Wisconsin's Freedom of Information Council's Vice President, Krista Westerberg, wrote recently in a column that ran in many of the South Central Wisconsin newspapers that proponents, or the state bar, have submitted no evidence that people criminally charged are regularly denied jobs. And so I'm here today, as many of the others have been, to offer themselves a proof that this does indeed happen. And it's all because of information. A lot of it happens because of information that's available on, and viewed on CCAP. I ran a small company, a small manufacturing firm in Reedsburg for 8 years, between 1996 and 2004. We had employed 40 people, and we had revenues in excess of $5 million per year. In 2008, I was charged with carrying a concealed weapon. And while completing the terms of that deferred prosecution, I applied and I enrolled in college and I was going to college full time. I applied for a job at Walmart to pick up some extra money over the holidays. Completed the application. On the application, they asked, "Have you ever been convicted of a crime?" And I checked no and completed the application and turned it in. On the way out of Walmart, I called my lawyer just to confirm, because my integrity means the world to me. And I called him and said, "Derek, I haven't been convicted, right?" He says, "No, Steve, I have a deferred prosecution, no conviction." Walmart runs a check on CCAP. They come back and say, "We see you have this deferred prosecution. Would you like to tell us more about that?" My response, being a former Marine, my response was kindly, "No, it wasn't a conviction. You only asked for convictions. This is not a conviction, and I don't feel compelled to divulge any of the facts surrounding that circumstance." And thusly, I was denied an $8 an hour job, a seasonal job, at Walmart. Wittenberg's position, or Westerberg's position, should be alarming to everybody in this room. The last half of her statement reads about how nobody's been regularly denied jobs, housing, or licenses because of discrimination related to their arrests. That statement is an affront, in my opinion, to everything this country's criminal justice system stands for. Regularly denied housing, jobs, or licenses? Isn't just one instance of being wrongfully discriminated against enough? Why do those acquitted or whose charges have been dropped have to suffer any discrimination? I suppose that I should be happy that she's not a governor in a capital punishment state, or perhaps we might be saying, we've accidentally executed only a few people, but it doesn't happen regularly. One job denied, one lease disapproved, one opportunity to live free and pursue happiness is too many. In closing, I'm not here for myself today. My future is secure. I'm here for those who could not or cannot afford the level of justice available to those who can afford the best lawyers. I'm here for those who aren't comfortable speaking in a setting such as we are this afternoon. When a person is acquitted or the charges are dismissed with prejudice, the character of the accused, in my opinion, the character of the accused should immediately be restored to that same status as it was before the charges were brought. And I don't think you should take any effort upon the good people of this great state of Wisconsin to do that. We get dragged unwillingly, unwittingly, unwantingly into these, and we live with the results for the rest of our lives. And so upon acquittal and the dismissal of the charges, I propose that there be provision made within CCAP, whether it's a tiered system, but of some nature, where acquittals and deferred prosecutions aren't available to those who aren't educated in what legal terms and what legal definitions mean, whether it's a closed case or dismissed charge. And then those end my comments, and I thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Paskey. Are there any questions?
How did you learn about this hearing today?
I learned about this hearing today because I just happened, while working on my homework, to catch a 10 o'clock newscast about Representative Marlon Schneider's AB 663, and I immediately contacted his office, and one of his staff members there informed me of the state bar's petition before the Supreme Court and suggested that maybe I'd be wanting to come down and address you fine people.
Yeah, thank you for coming. It's a lot to take time out of your day. We really appreciate it.
It's a very meaningful issue to a lot of very good people.
Thank you.
Do I understand you to say that this particular petition would not help you?
I'm not a lawyer, although lawyers have moved up a couple of notches in my esteem as a result of them understanding that there's this issue here where good people are being harmed. And so the legal aspects of the issue, I'm not equipped to address intelligently. But what I'm saying is that CCAP needs to be looked at. It needs to be looked at. And, like, I'm okay with myself. I know what happened. I know why it happened. And I have enough confidence in myself that I will succeed going into the future. So if it doesn't benefit me, that's not why I'm here. You know, it's for the people that come after me.
Understand.
One of you, Chief, if I may, you mentioned you were on a deferred prosecution, or is it a conditional discharge? That's evolved here as a little bit of an issue, and I know some of the people who've submitted writings are, and so
would,
the judges
would you,
are in
would you
favor
like to hear my opinion on deferred prosecutions?
Sure.
I'll keep it brief. I know we're under some time constraints. I was sold a deferred prosecution as a way that the district attorney gets her numbers so that when she runs for re-election, she has numbers to show that she's doing her job. While at the same time, upon successful completion of the deferred prosecution, the charge goes away. It never happened to me. So I viewed it, as it was explained to me, as a win-win. I didn't have $10,000 to come to Madison and buy a lawyer that said, we can get you off of these charges, Steve. I have a daughter to take care of. I'm going to college. And so I opted to take the deferred prosecution and keep that money in my pocket for better purposes, as I viewed it at the time. And so I think that the public is hoodwinked a little bit, and they're being sold a bill of goods that the state or the county who wins on both accounts. They get their conviction numbers, and they get to hold somebody out there as a pinata for the rest of their life to the general public. I'm not saying that there's not a need for law enforcement to see histories of past occurrences, but I'm saying the average person, uneducated in the legal terms and definitions as they're used in our courts, they don't have the abilities. They see it, and based on what the references that I gave you in my notes, we are predisposed as human beings to view things, to view negative facts as truth, because it's the only thing that offsets all the good things that person has. It's like, aha, see, I knew they were like that. And they'll run with it, whether it's just a neighbor or a potential employer, they'll run with it. And that's my opinion.
Thank you. You were then charged, and then there was deferred prosecution. Sometimes there's deferred prosecution or conditional without having a charge filed, but you're on paper in the DA's office, and I think that's one of the points of this conversation. And what you say is somewhat correct, that if it doesn't get on paper and in whatever system is used in the district attorney's office, then the workload is computed and the need for additional assistant district attorneys depend on how they calculate the workload. And if they're doing deferred prosecution without enough, without a paper being filed in the court and that's not counted, then they're doing the same amount of work or even more, but it doesn't count. And the office then becomes understaffed and overloaded. I mean, I'm trying to explain to you why.
But when we're dragged,
I'm not supporting the system. I'm telling you why it happens.
Right. And Your Honor, with all due respect, when you're dragged into the criminal justice system unwittingly and unwillingly, your mind is awash in myriad thoughts and concerns and issues, the least of which you hire a lawyer to go out and act in your best interest. And perhaps they convey that to you in a way that you understand correctly, and maybe you don't. And so you agree to something at the time in the heat of the moment that down the road, looking back through that hindsight 2020 mirror, that you wouldn't otherwise have had they explained it more thoroughly.
Well, this court faces this problem in terms of what should a judge be telling people who appear in court, either initially or at the end at sentencing. And one of the issues is what people do understand and how much they can absorb when they're under that kind of pressure. So first thing that ran through my mind is somebody ought to tell somebody that their CCAP, WCCA, and you're going to be on it. But then I'm not, which sounds like a good idea, but I'm not so sure anyone understands it or can absorb it.
And again, within the professional community, I don't doubt that state agencies or law enforcement agencies, I don't deny the fact that there might be a use for and a need for that information, but I'm saying as far as the general public is concerned, it's a form of reality television, only in written context, and this hearing wouldn't be happening today if you could discern from written text the true scope of a situation. I mean, we need the visual effects. We need the emotions. We need to hear that. We need to see that to truly communicate. And that doesn't happen on CCAP. It's one-sided.
Sir, I too would like to share my appreciation of your time and effort for being here. I do want to note, though, in just a little bit more than passing, that there are any number of reasons for deferred prosecution agreements, and I do not endorse the idea that they are filed for the idea of building numbers. You may have heard one explanation for them, but there are a variety of very legitimate reasons why deferred prosecution agreements would be entered into. I know nothing about the facts of your case, but I don't want to sit here and listen to one version of why they might be and have them painted in a negative fashion. But again, I commend you for putting the effort forward and taking the time to share your story. Again, it is obviously out of sincere and good motives that you are here, and I am appreciative of it.
Thank you for your comments, Your Honor.
Thank you, Ms. Paskey. Pat Rabbit, former Chief of Police of Marinette. Did I pronounce your name correctly?
Thank you. It's Patrick Rabay.
Rabay, I did not. Thank you.
First off, I'd like to thank you for the honor of being here. We only found out about this about a week ago, reading an AP story in the Green Bay Press Gazette the Saturday before this. So we tried to put something together because we've been working on infringement things up there for some time. I was 30 years on the Marinette Police Department. I worked in a prison system for 3 years as a correctional officer before that. So I'm not at all soft on crime, but I do think the infringement records are a little strict, and I'd like to share some things with you. First 5 to 7 years of my career, I was a patrol officer. I worked as a criminal investigator for 10 to 12 years. With the last 3 years, I was in charge of the Criminal Investigation Department for the City of Marinette, and I served the last 13 years of my career as the Chief of Police. There were a lot of criminals incarcerated as a result of my police work. A lot of people I arrested were repeat offenders. I do believe if you commit the crime, you should do the time. Some of those arrested for murder, and I believe they should be either depending on what state they're in and what the laws are there, if they have the death penalty, or at least, like Wisconsin, locked up for the rest of their life. Other than that, I think our laws could use a different interpretation or a different change that they seem so strict. There's so many people out there that could live a good life if they had an opportunity to get a job and not have to have this record follow them forever for 50 years because they committed a crime that they were sentenced to 1 year in prison for, and 50 years later, it's still, people can go into their record and find it, and they have to face jobs and just everything else in society. I lost a friend I grew up with when I went in the Army. He went the other way. He started stealing cars, and he just never got out of the circle because he couldn't find a decent job after that. He had nothing to look forward to, and he died really young. As far as crime in general, like I say, murders is a different thing, and sex offenders, there's no knowledge of any type of psychological or psychiatry course or anything that I've ever taken that has shown that we can rehabilitate them, so I think they have to be watched forever. Other than those crimes, I think we could talk about lowering our expungement laws, maybe 20 to 25 years instead of 50. So at least they had something to look forward to down the line that they could start over. They could get a job as a security officer, or they could marry a police officer or somebody in the military that owns a gun and be able to move in their house and start over. I believe we as Americans have always been a forgiving people. And if no more crimes have been committed after the sentence has been served, they should be able to have something to look forward to. I strongly believe we wouldn't have as many repeat offenders if we gave them something to look forward to, such as a clear record, even if it is 20 to 25 years down the road after they live crime-free lives. Thank you for letting me express my thoughts. I've worked with a person that I investigated a crime on some 34 years ago. And I don't know if there's a way, you know, that we can interpret the expungement laws. I know the United States Supreme Court interpreted Miranda law so bad or so broad that they changed the whole law by the time they interpreted it. It was a different law entirely than we had been working with for years and years as police officers. And I don't quite understand the part about a defendant committing a crime before the age of 25. I would hope that, you know, he wouldn't have to wait decades to be able to get an expungement. If the court feels it can't interpret the law, couldn't it please urge the legislature to make new laws so that a person doesn't have to serve or carry a 50-year sentence for a one-year crime that they committed when they only had 1 year? The person that I worked with, one particular case I'd like to share with you, that happened many, many years ago, going back 34 years, involved a husband and a wife and a girlfriend, and by the time I had to investigate it, I wanted to read the defendant her rights, and she invoked Miranda and said she didn't want to talk to me, and I had to stop exactly right there. But then the other two didn't stop. The husband and wife turned around and blamed it all on her. And so she got the year in the prison, and the husband got off with a lighter sentence, did county jail time, and the wife suffered what should have been a misdemeanor into a felony and did a year in jail. And in working, I've stayed in touch with her, and we've met throughout town through the years, maybe once or twice a year, sometimes many more. And she shared this with me. I am writing in regards to expunging a felony record. I'd like to see records expunged after a specific amount of time, provided that person leads a law-abiding life after years of release. So she did 1 year, and she's still here 30-some years later suffering for it. I was convicted of a felony at the age of 19. It was a crime I regret. And at 19, I had no clue to life I was going to encounter after my incarceration. I was immature at 19, and as most 19-year-olds, didn't think past the next week, let alone the rest of my life. I was sentenced to a year, and I did 8.5 months. I did not have money for a lawyer. My mother was poor, so my attorney was paid with a truckload of firewood. I was not entitled to a court-appointed attorney because I had $1,000 in savings from all my past birthdays and selling my bicycle when I was 15 years old. While being incarcerated, I received my GED, which is equivalent to a high school diploma, put on a work release program after 4 months to work off the ground, and I worked steady until I was released. Upon returning back home, within a few months, I applied for a job as a nurse's aide. I was trained on the job. I went out and bought a uniform and shoes for my job, and I went to work a four-hour shift in the early morning, in the a.m., and by early afternoon, I received a phone call from the establishment that they had to terminate me as they found out I had a felony record. I married, had two children. After my youngest was 8 months old, I decided to get a job again. I applied for a job, fill out the application. On this application was a question regarding any felony convictions. I filled it out and waited. I was interviewed and felt very strongly that the conviction was the reason I did not hear back. I reapplied, and later, a parole officer gave me this advice, and I was called for another interview. I ended up taking action against the employer for not hiring me due to my felony conviction, and with that, I was hired. I was employed there for 18 years. I then divorced and no longer was working as a second income. I was going to be the only income and needed a better paying job to survive. I was scared to death how I was going to manage this with a criminal record. I proceeded to following the advice of the parole officer from before and leave that section blank on the application. I was hired and have been employed for the last 13 years. The majority of the people I work with do not know of my past or any past. Anyone under 44 would probably know nothing about this crime as it was 34 years ago, but I have to live day to day in fear that someone may find us out and have to deal with the situation all over again. I have experienced problems when my children were in school. Some parents of my children's friends recalled what I had done and expressed to their kids that they did not want them to associate with my kids. Some of these adults weren't any better than me, but they had been in trouble in their younger years and there wasn't any convictions that you could put on a computer screen. I encountered another incident in which a woman that did not like me was mentally unstable and sent my daughter pictures of pornography in the mail. There was a complaint filed and the woman did go to court and was found guilty. She broadcasted to my workplace that I had been in prison and therefore tried to turn things around so that I should have never filed charges because I was not any better. My kids are standing law-abiding citizens. My son has been in military for almost 13 years and my daughter has put herself through college, received a bachelor's degree. And they are both wonderful people. I don't have bad blood in which my kids were created. I feel I did a good job in raising my children, and this burden of mine can be a disgrace to them. About last October, things were not looking good at my workplace. We encountered numerous layoffs. There's rumors of shutting down. I was not sure where I stood as far as employment. I started to panic, as I would be in real bad shape should I lose my job. My son asked me to come to Arizona to be closer to his family, enabled me to spend more time with my grandson, as this is a dream of mine. My first gut reaction was, oh no, now what do I do? I called Pat Relave, which is myself, a longtime friend, a retired chief of police, as to his thoughts. I wanted to know if my records could be easily accessed and what he thought about military running a check for a civilian job and etc. And I explained to her that this could happen. I want more than anything in the world to move to Arizona and spend time with my grandson while he's young. I am being held back due to my conviction record of 34 years ago. As I understand it, her son thinks he could probably get her a job on the base if it wasn't for this, if her record was expunged. But she can't get a job like that if she's got a felony record and she's around weapons. My son doesn't stop to think that the obstacles that are in my way and my kids were taught not to pass judgment on people. I explained that I needed a job and insurance. He told me that I could be their nanny, but I cannot do this as I need to prepare financially for retirement. He then went on to say that I could get a job at base because there's lots of civilians. There's no way I can take a chance of trying to apply for a job on a military base and not fear them running a background check. I don't want to embarrass my son of this either. He's making a career of the service, even though he is aware of it. As it stands now, I could never marry anyone that owns a firearm, whether it be a hunting, security, or military. I could never work in a job that involves firearms. Since my release in 1977, I have held a steady job, owned my own home, paid taxes. I've been a law-abiding citizen, no more convictions, no more arrests. I feel after 34 years I should not have to feel this lurking around every corner. It's an obstacle that is always preventing me from a happy, peaceful, normal life. Until recently, I had no idea there was a mandatory retention time. And although I understand this is what was up for discussion today, I would hope that this would be taken into consideration for hopes of changing the retention times for the expungement of criminal records. I was 19 at the time and soon to be 54. I was facing a 15-year sentence. I received 1 year, but according to the fact, I did 8.5 months, but mentally will serve 50 years and emotionally am doing a life sentence. I truly hope you will not take this lightly and will seriously give it some thought. I would like to see what a normal life would be like. This would also cover the person that was going to testify right behind me, as I've stated her case for her, so you wouldn't have to call her, Your Honor.
Who is that?
Lori.
Lori, she's number 19. Thank you.
And she wants a
Lori's statement is on file with us.
And she wants to remain anonymous for obvious reasons. She would want to have to go through this all over again in the community. And she's still trying to hang in there. She's still working. She's still got a job. And she has to face people at work.
And your statement is on file too, Mr.
Yes. Rabbit. Your Honor. And I think 20 to 25 years would be more fair in expungement, and it would be fair to the public also, the individuals as well as the public. And I want to thank you so much for allowing me to address you. I picked up a notebook to try to put this stuff together in a week, and I was going to talk about coming north at attention line. We got up at 4 o'clock this morning to drive down here, and I don't really find the tension here. I find this a very relaxed and caring and a good court. Your helpers, your assistants, Cynthia and Teresa, have been wonderful in helping us try to get set up and get here and be able to testify, and I thank them very much. And I thank you for allowing me to be here.
Well, we appreciate your coming. Ms. Owens advised us of the request for anonymity and first names, and we appreciate your calling that to our attention. So thank you for coming. We've driven to Marinette often. It's the same amount of time from here to Marinette as Marinette to here.
I think we have a common friend in Marinette named Lori.
Yes. Well, I think we might have.
Thank you all very much.
Thank you. Mr. Mowers, past president of the State Bar of Wisconsin.
Good afternoon, Chief Justice, members of the court. I've been living with this issue for 30-some years. I started my career as a prosecutor, and I've been defending people charged with crimes for the last 30 years, after 9 years as a prosecutor. When I started as a prosecutor, our deferred prosecution program authorized people to avoid the criminal justice system altogether by going through the program, and then subsequently their charge was not brought, so they weren't faced with this. The current system requires people to plead guilty to the charge, not just no contest.
It depends from county to county.
And it varies from county to county. In some counties, they still have a program that doesn't require people to go to court.
Right.
And so the impact of these decisions on people varies from county to county and from person to person. One of the things that I tried to listen to the questions, and I wanted to try to answer some of the questions, because much of the base information of this petition came from an idea I had and formulated with a group of people, and we all put together ideas to try to make a program that would work, that would allow the justices to take the correct action. There was a question about, well, does this open it up and how can we do this, because the statute doesn't permit it. The statute only permits expunction or expungement in cases where someone is actually convicted of an offense. There is no procedure under Wisconsin law, statutory, for deleting records of people who are not convicted. And that's why we brought this, because people who are acquitted or not convicted, who are innocent, have a very difficult choice to make. I sit them down in my office and I say, we can go to trial in this case. We can accept the prosecutor's offer of a deferred prosecution. But if we accept a deferred prosecution, it will remain on your record on the CCAP system. We can ask for expungement if you're young enough. If you're not young enough, we can't ask for expungement. And if we ask for expungement, you have to be convicted. And they say, how can I be convicted? I didn't do it. The DA is offering to dismiss. Well, if it's dismissed, it's going to stay on your record for 20 or 75 years. And so I've had clients who have elected to have expungement when they were innocent because they didn't want the scarlet letter. And in this case, the scarlet letter is not A. It's CF or CM. Those are the scarlet letters that people are branded by the Wisconsin Circuit Court Access Program. You're asking about your authority to do this. And I derived the initial idea for this from Rule 7206, which authorizes the court under its current iteration to expunge cases when required by statute or court order, which must presume that there is the authority within the court to enter such an order. And I have made that argument all over the state, And most of the time, with the concurrence of the prosecutor in the correct cases, not always, and most of the time the judges have granted this. But the problem is for those people who don't have lawyers, who don't understand the significance of the branding that occurs, some of whom you've heard from today, who end up being charged, who end up perhaps being convicted of something, and have that record for a long time. One of the reasons we propose that the retention rules be changed somewhat to allow that the period of retention tracks the actual disposition of the case is that if someone is unfortunate enough to not have a lawyer or someone telling their side before the charging decision and they're charged with a felony, even though it may be amended to an ordinance violation that goes away after 5 years, their record stays for 70 years or 50 years because it's a felony on the initial CF branding of the case. And it just seems to me that the final disposition ought to be the place that determines how long a record is retained rather than the initial charging decision. Because we have an adversary system and it's designed that way. We have a system that presumes people innocent until they're proven guilty. I was just looking and counting up, and I didn't complete my list. I have a list of all the other states, and there are 49 states listed here. Wisconsin is the only state that does not, well, excuse me, most other states have expungement statutes. And it appears to me from a brief review, and I don't want to cite numbers or I'll be in the same trouble as Marlon Schneider, but it appears to me that the vast majority of them allow records to be expunged if someone is acquitted or the charges are dismissed. And that is within the authority of the court because it is the court record. And as Mr. Gunther pointed out to you in the Nixon case, the Supreme Court indicated that the best place to look to for a type of decision as to what to do about public access to records, and I'll quote from the Nixon case at 435 U.S. at 599, the decision as to access is one best left to the sound discretion of the trial court, a discretion to be exercised in light of the relevant facts and circumstances of the particular case. That is why we proposed a procedure that authorizes a trial court to consider this and make the determination. And it was in conjunction with other trial court judges that I added the provision here that says that it doesn't have to be right away because my experience was, as Judge Kinney indicated, oftentimes I would show up in court and argue for expunction and the judge would take it under advisement. The request has to be made at the time of sentencing, but the judges all said, but I don't have to rule on it yet. I want to see how you do. And you come back here in a year or 2 years and show me that you have straightened your life out and you haven't gotten any more trouble. Then I'll consider your expunction request and probably grant it. And then we put a tickler in and file our motion and come back, and assuming the client has not strayed again, the expunction request is granted. The reason that we put in the provision for a particular period of time is that reason that the trial courts were giving us, that that's what they want to see. They don't want to have to make a decision on expungement at the time of sentencing when a person hasn't really demonstrated very much other than they were charged with something and convicted. So, and in these cases where someone is, the charges are dismissed or acquitted, it's a different situation because they're not being convicted of a crime, and I tell them you don't have to check yes on the job applications. But you may want to, because there's going to be a record of this in CCAP and people might read it wrong. And so you have to be advised of that. And so I advise my clients of that. But it can create problems for people, and it often does. And you've heard some of the horror stories of people who have had allegations brought against them that have been completely false. There are cases where people are victims of mistaken identity, of identity theft. Todd Moyer, our court commissioner who handles traffic cases in Dane County, regularly, even before the CCAP rules were changed, would delete entries, would direct the court to expunge records when someone came in and proved to them that it was not them driving the car that got the speeding ticket. He would both dismiss the case and order the record removed from CCAT because he felt he had the authority to do that. And CCAP now authorizes that in cases of mistaken identity. What I'm asking the court to do and what the state bar is asking, and by the way, this was a unanimous decision by the Board of Governors of the state bar that presented this. It was not unanimous in the criminal law section. I think there were two or three votes against our proposal, and I think one of them was because it didn't go far enough, because it really doesn't. But it's a very good first step, and it's a step that this body can take to really correct some injustices, to help people who are truly harmed by this. I've had clients who come to me 5 years after their case who've completed drug treatment court, and we try to get people into drug treatment court because it's such a terrific program, and it helps people, and it rehabilitates them, and they can get rid of their drug problems through the assistance that they get provided. And they get done, and they complete school, and they go out and apply for a job. And they look and they look them up on CCAP and see, even though their charges are dismissed and they're not supposed to be discriminated against, you can't tell me that the reason that some of my clients are not getting jobs is not this. Because I know those clients, and I know their circumstances. And they are being harmed by this. And that's why we're asking you to do this. It's to help some of these people who have spoken to you today and many, many others who are afraid to come out because they've been victimized enough. And I would like to answer any questions you have about the different provisions within that or some of the questions that perhaps you had about different points that Mr. Gunther raised, or anyone else.
I don't know if you got a chance to look at John Velker's memorandum, or letter, I should say, on this. And then
I did, but it was some time ago, and I apologize. I originally had planned to be here Friday when it was originally scheduled, and I'd made arrangements to go to the Olympics. I just got back last night, so I haven't had a chance to review that
lately. Time.
It was wonderful, except the curling team didn't do so well.
Are you a curler?
Can have everything.
My wife's niece is on the curling team,
and
so we had a personal interest in that. But Mark Johnson and the hockey team, the women's hockey team, is doing great. They were awesome.
All right.
Mr. Volkers.
Yeah.
Yes.
So he says you've included, I mean, this is assuming you can get over all the other little problems, but these are technical things. Because of the inclusion of dismissed ordinance violations, will the expunction provisions apply to municipal courts? And he says this will be a new record-keeping procedure for them.
And it's specifically, you don't have any authority to really, I think the municipal courts do their own, and that I can tell you right now that when I have a client who's charged with an operating under the influence case in municipal court, we don't ask for a jury trial in circuit court to keep the case out of the CCAP program quite often. We discuss that, but we don't want the case to be in the CCAP program, even though it's going to be on their driving record, because that is a public record, far more accessible to everyone. And the municipal court records have not proven to be a problem because of the fact that they're just not that accessible to people. They're accessible within the municipality, but they're not.
So you don't care about them then?
Nope.
Okay.
Don't care about municipal court records.
All right.
They don't seem to have much impact on people's lives. Although there are issues there, but they're not the issues we're dealing with here.
All right. He says, the retention section of the petition clearly applies only to criminal and ordinance, but this limitation is not clear in the expunction section. Are other dismissed cases subject to expunction, particularly, he says, TROs and injunction cases? Because he says expunction is limited to criminal No, its function is not limited to criminal inordinance.
And I believe that that may be a correct reading. I went through the statutes to find a definition, really, for expungement and expunction, and didn't find one. The only definition that I found was in your rule, 7206. Mm-hmm. So I can't tell whether it's limited to criminal cases or not. I know that there's case law that that expunction does not apply to ordinance violations, as at least under the statutory scheme that we have. Whether this court rule could make it apply to those cases, that's up to you. You could make it apply to TRO cases, which I think would be very helpful to some of these people who have been accused of these things. I can tell you that I'm familiar with a number of cases where TROs were brought inappropriately without a basis, and because the person had a lawyer, they were able to convince the court that it would have a deleterious effect on their client and would not be in the public interest, and the courts ordered those records removed or expunged in different counties around the state. I know judges do that.
Not uniformly, though.
Not uniformly. And that's one of the things that you can guide us on if you make changes to this rule, is which cases this would apply to. Because those are cases that can truly cause problems for people.
Counselor, are you really talking about expunction, or are you talking about record retention? Expunction means there is a record. It's sealed. It's kept there. Record, I mean, are you really saying you want these to be sealed from the public view? You want expunction? Or are you saying that you don't want record retention? Or are you saying that you don't want them to be on the CCAP system? Or are you saying you just want the records destroyed? Tell me what you're saying. Because okay, we use these words, and they have special meaning in the law, and that's why I'm having a harder time getting my arms around this, because some people are saying, I don't want it on the computer system for the whole wide world to see, especially if I've been acquitted or the case is dismissed. It causes havoc in my life, right? Other people are using the term expunction, which means that you remove a paper index and a non-financial court record, place them in the case file, electronically remove automated non-financial records except case number, seal the case file, and destroy expunged court records in accordance with certain provisions. You know, and then you have other provisions in here regarding retention of court records that deal with all sorts of things, and you know, people are talking about 20 years, but you also have, for example, OWI cases, drunk driving cases. They're kept for 5 years.
But they're actually
the minimum. You know, and I wonder what some people would say if they thought, well, gee, after 5 years, you know, we don't have to go, we aren't allowed to know if someone had a previous drunk driving conviction. I bet that's not what you're talking about, especially since our legislature spent a whole lot of time making sure that they make drunk driving laws tougher, not easier. So, you got a few glitches here you got to help me with, and you have to help me with whether you're really talking retention, which means keeping the court file, whether you're talking expunction, or whether you're talking some hybrid of that, or if you're just saying in cases where someone's acquitted or a case is dismissed, we're dealing with that differently. These are very different things. Or are you saying, if someone's convicted after a certain period of time, that should be hidden from the public view? I'm not sure what you're saying.
Okay. I'll try to answer your question. First, as to OWI cases, there's a specific provision in the statute that requires the Department of Transportation to keep those records in perpetuity for any OWI cases.
But so the retention of records only calls for 5 years.
In an ordinance violation case, it does.
No, in
a criminal case.
7201, traffic forfeiture, conservation forfeiture, clerk of circuit court cases, the cases
right,
that you don't want your clients to end up in court on,
right,
it's 5 years.
Those are the cases. The first offense OWIs are forfeiture violations that are under your current rule are kept for 5 years. And what this language does is parrot the current rule. That is what your current rule says.
Oh, tell me, in a drunk driving case, after 5 years, I can go back to the judge and say, hey, take this off the record, remove it completely, no one should know about it. Is that what you're saying?
I'm saying that the current 7206 indicates that a forfeiture case, the record must be retained for 5 years and no longer, and it's not supposed to be kept. The legislature, in response to that, changed the law and provided that a record of a conviction is kept by the Department of Transportation so that that record remains for a person's lifetime now. It does not apply to an OWI case, except that it does create problems sometimes for people because those records are not kept. Forfeiture records are not kept for longer than 5 years by the clerks of court because of the current rule.
Right.
I'm not asking that that be changed. That isn't part of this. That's why we tried to parrot the current rule in our definition of what expunction means.
So tell me exactly what you want to have happen. If I'm someone who's convicted of a crime and I've served my time, what do I get to do?
Under this rule, if you're convicted of an ordinance violation,
of a crime,
if it's a misdemeanor, that record stays on the system for 20 years under this proposal.
In CCAP.
In CCAP and on the system for 20 years. This proposal does not expand that provision of the law at all. This proposal indicates that if a charge is amended to a lesser violation, that it stays on the record for the period of record retention of that, the ultimate disposition of the case.
If substantial battery is reduced down to battery, then it's going to be 20 years instead of...
Right. Or if it's determined that it's not really that big a deal, that the information that the prosecutor had was incomplete, and they decide to make it an ordinance violation, which happens, it would go away after 5 years. But if the case is dismissed, or the person is acquitted, or there's a deferred prosecution agreement, then the person would have the ability to come into court and request the court to make a determination as to whether or not the record could or should be expunged after doing the balancing test.
So
that's what we're asking.
So you're not really looking to change much for convictions. Those would stay on someone's record.
That's correct.
Your real rub is when it comes to acquittals and dismissals. Right?
That's correct. That's what
and
this.
And so then I'm acquitted of a felony charge. What happens when I'm acquitted? I then petition the court for what?
You would have the authority to petition the court for expunction, and the court would determine whether society would be harmed and whether you would benefit from
and
the court granting.
When you use the term expunction, are you saying the record should be destroyed, or are you saying they should be sealed in a court file?
My personal opinion is that the record should be sealed in a court file. The current rule is somewhat confusing, and I did track the current court rule because I presumed there was a reason that you said the court records shall be destroyed. I didn't know which court records you were referring to, and so I didn't want to trample on the court's authority to decide which records would be destroyed, if any. My personal preference is that it would be sealed so it would be available for people to review, for the media to review, because...
What would the standard be for unsealing a record, and how would someone know it exists?
They would have the ability to look at the case number and go to the clerk and ask what's going on with this case, and the court could say
case number. I know they sound really fundamental to you, but I'm looking at it from a trial court judge perspective.
Right.
This is what I did.
Right.
You know, so you come to the court, you say I've been acquitted. The court says fine. Use your term. I'm going to expunge your record. What does that mean? Does that mean then the clerk of court comes down, grabs the court file, seals it, and puts it in some private place, and it's never on CCAP, and it's never in a computer system, and the number is no longer existent anywhere for anyone to know about?
No. Our proposal is that there would still be a case number. The non-financial aspects of the record would remain, and the case file would be ordered sealed and put in a separate place, which is what I understand currently occurs when a case is ordered expunged now in circuit court.
I still have State versus Ziegler 09 CF 416, and the fact that some charge was out there, it'll just be sort of unknown what happened to the file?
No, the name is removed. The name of the case. The only thing that remains is the case number.
You haven't changed 72.06.
No.
And you're saying that you don't know what subsection 4 means, destroy.
Correct.
It's possible it means destroy it under the retention system.
It is. I'm not certain. Mm-hmm. And when I tried to ask a clerk of courts about it, they just said that they seal the records.
They don't give legal advice.
Well, I know that. Yes.
Let's just walk through your petition. It's in our tab 1.
Yes.
So with regard to 7201, retention of original records, and that's one of the things you were just discussing, from your proposal, that's just the way that it is and has been. There's a certain length of time for civil cases and files and judgments and all sorts of stuff set out in 7201.
Correct.
That you don't touch that.
Correct.
Now you have a 72015, and this is a part of your petition that deals with retention. The next part deals with expungement, but this deals with retention. So 72015, it looks to me like there are some new concepts here. One concept you talked about was that you are labeling the type of case at the time of final disposition as opposed to, for purposes of records retention, the kind of case it was when it was filed. So that's one thing you're trying to accomplish with
Correct.
This change.
Correct.
You're also trying to accomplish, it seems to me, that when there's multiple counts, you take the longest retention period of any one count after final disposition. That's another thing you're trying to accomplish. Is there anything else that you're trying to accomplish with regards to retention of the original felony, misdemeanor, or forfeiture in your proposed new 72015?
No.
Okay. Then we go to that portion of the petition that deals with expunction. And we've set that out in sub 1. Looks to me like all of that language is new. This is brand new for us. Am I correct?
You're correct, except that the provision 1A currently reads, when authorized or required to do so by statute or court order.
Okay.
But
other than that, it's all new stuff.
That's the introduction to 7206.
Correct.
That's the language. She's pulled it out of 7. Yeah. Okay, got it.
I know that.
All right.
Okay. So then you, in 7206, as you propose this paradigm, that a court may order a court record expunged under the following circumstances. Number one, when authorized to do by statute, actually A. B, on motion of any party after the expiration of the minimum retention. And C, which seems to have gotten most of our attention here today, upon dismissal of the case or acquittal. So that's the, and then it has to be, of course, if it's dismissal and acquittal in the interest of justice and benefiting society and making that balancing.
Right.
Is that a summary of what this is doing? Okay.
That is.
Then the next part of your petition is 7206 sub 2. And that doesn't look to me like you've hardly changed anything in terms of defining what expunction is. You just use the existing court court rule 7206 sub 2 and how what the clerk has to do, you know, take out the papers, leave the case numbers, seal the entire file. Sub 4 deals with that word destroy, and I don't know. But the only thing you've added is E to all of this stuff dealing with how the court has previously and currently deals with expungement. And the thing that you've added is notifying the Department of Justice.
I believe the current 72 also does require that. I think that it's a typo that it wasn't listed as another subsection here. My recollection of 7206 is that it currently does require notification of the Department of Justice.
John Velker's comment as to this is, first, as to the case types, which is what Justice Bradley
began with, says, he says that that's a significant change in the workload to move from the initiation case type to the closing case type. And he says that that might be proved troublesome. Extra work.
Right.
For all of this. That's at the bottom
one
of this page six. Pardon me. Go ahead.
I apologize.
No. Oh.
One of the reasons that I put in, that we put in the language that on a motion to the party of the case or after the expiration of the minimum retention period is that I do not presume that most clerks of court are going to want to go through all of their files and records to determine what the final disposition was.
Right.
It's only under those cases where people are impacted by the fact of the record that they would have the gumption to go in and ask that this be removed because the expiration of the period. That's why this proposed rule change was crafted the way it was, to eliminate the majority of the work for the clerks of court. I recognize that it will result, presumably, if this rule is changed, in an initial influx of cases from some people who are being harmed by this. Mm-hmm. But I don't think that if people understand this and if the proper forms are created by the forms department, that it would create an unduly burdensome problem for courts, because those types of decisions would not require necessarily even a hearing because of the fact that it would have passed the retention period and they're just asking that that record be removed.
John Velker says that 7206E requiring notification to the department is new. He also says, and I'm just
referring to the notification
right.
to the Department of Justice. At least it doesn't appear in my...
And I apologize. I think that what happened is before your most recent change, I believe this was in there, and then it was eliminated for whatever reason, probably because of the workload issue.
Well, John Velker says the section is unnecessary. An electronic interface between DOJ and the court system has provided this information promptly and accurately as required by statute for more than 10 years. So it's obviously on the books somewhere else, and it's
right.
done automatically, because you probably know we've worked with collaboratively with
yes.
As allies with Department of Justice as well as law enforcement.
Right.
On transferring information, so
right.
we'd have this.
And if that's unnecessary, it could be deleted mm-hmm. without...
Okay. And I think, I'm sorry, but I don't keep everything in my head, but I think the Department of Justice objected to any concept that the court could tell the department what records to keep. And, you know, rightly so, if we're talking about separation of powers,
right.
it's a two-way street on this.
Okay.
All right. Then John says the clerk's records versus CCAP records. The State's Bar's memo on page 5, lines 1 and 2, refers to a record maintained by the clerk as well as a record maintained by CCAP for any case. The clerk's record and the records maintained by CCAP are one and the same. If they're different, there's problems. I mean, something went wrong because CCAP doesn't make up records. CCAP takes only what the clerks of court give CCAP, and if there's a change at the clerk's office, it's supposed to be a change then at CCAP. So the language here would have to be dealt with so that we make sure that it is only one record that we're all talking about. The other thing that John says is that there would be a workload impact here. And he gives statistics as to the case dispositions and dismissals, and there are substantial numbers involved here. This would be what would be of relatively recent cases. And he says others would request expunction for already closed cases. So at least initially, it'd be a substantial influx of cases, maybe. Do you disagree?
I don't disagree that there would be an initial influx of cases. Many of the people who've testified would want to have their records corrected. And I'm presuming that there are many, many other people out there who would want to have their records corrected. I don't think it would be an unreasonable workload, and I don't think it would impact the administration of justice negatively, because it would be doing justice in a particular case that needs to be done. It would create an initial influx, but I think once the system was put in place, it would, I think, work rather smoothly.
He says that there would be have to be designed new tracking and filing systems for the clerk's office to accommodate this, but he says that once that was done, the cases should not impose a significant workload impact on the clerk's office. I wanted to give you some good news, too.
Thank you.
You're welcome. All right.
May I ask a couple of questions here? Mr. Maurice, you heard the testimony of Chief Rivette, I believe his name is.
Yes.
The case that he cited, does this rule provide any remedy for the woman that he cited?
I do not believe it would. She was a woman who was convicted of a felony case, and this proposal would not impact that. There are proposals in the legislature that potentially would, but not this proposal. The other gentleman who testified, I believe his case would be impacted by this, because he went through a deferred prosecution program and his charges were dismissed. So he would have the ability to petition the court to ask that his record be cleared. So it would help some of the people, but not all of the people.
You're still taking a small step, relatively.
Correct.
Relatively.
I'm trying to limit what we can accomplish to what I perceive your authority to be. I think statutory changes would probably be necessary to broaden the concept of expungement. Expungement or expunction, whichever.
If there was a guilty.
Yes, people who are convicted.
Or a conviction.
Yes, right.
In your proposed 7206, 1C, upon dismissal of the case, does case mean an entire matter as opposed to individual counts within a matter?
I believe case means the entire matter, and I think that that's why the other section of the rule indicates that if there are multiple charges within a case, that the most serious ultimate case is the one that counts. This would also, because the court would have the ability to consider this, it would not result in the removal or expunction of a case, for example, that's dismissed and read in. The judge would, in all likelihood, not expunge that record or that type of record if there are multiple cases pending against the person. But this would be in the effect of one case. And this is also designed to give the court the discretion if there are several cases pending and one is dismissed, the person would not be able to ask that charge be expunged.
But if an individual were charged with, say, four different offenses, some quite serious, and the person ended up with, say, a misdemeanor conviction, but all the felonies were dismissed, the result? What would be the result?
I would presume that a judge looking at that would deny any motion filed to expunge that record. That would be my presumption, because the judge would consider the interests of society and the interests of the individual, whether the individual could be harmed. And that's why we tried to put in the balancing test, so the judge would have the authority, the prosecutor would be there, could speak to the issue. So if it was a plea bargain where a person's charges were being, three were being dismissed and one was being amended to a misdemeanor, but they were pretty serious and the judge felt strongly about it, certainly the judge would not expunge any of the charges, any of the cases.
What does the phrase reasonable period of time mean?
I've asked that for years and years, and I don't know that there's a definition that you can really give except within the context of a factual situation. For some judges, a reasonable period of time might be a year or 2 years. For some judges, it might be 5 years, depending on the type of case. If someone's charged with a felony, for example, and they go through a deferred prosecution program, but it's a fairly serious felony, a judge might say, I want you to stay straight for 5 years before I'll consider this. So that might be a reasonable period of time in one case. In another case, the judge might decide there doesn't need to be the passage of time. So it's going to depend on the facts of the case.
There's been some suggestion here that if the CCAP system, or whatever people want to call it, is significantly changed, there might be the development of a private alternative system. Could you comment on that?
Yeah, there very well could be the development of a private system. I know that from speaking to the people that work with the Wisconsin Circuit Court Access Program, that their data is currently mined by professional organizations that use those records and gather that data and use that. What I'm concerned about, and I don't know that this court has much authority to do much about that, what I'm concerned about is that the official government label that's put on gives the fact that a person was charged with a crime some imprimatur, so to speak, and gives government credence to it. And that's what I'm trying to help my clients be able to prevent somehow, so that they are not facing the government discrimination or the government label, I guess. The private companies, you know, some of these cases are in the media, and they can Google them and find out what happened anyway.
And it'll be to the economic interest to get this information, so we just make it easier for them.
We do currently, right. But I think taking it off the official record would really be helpful to people, because then they could use that information to help them.
Mr. Maurer, say the court was inclined to see it your way and to say that, yes, this is a petition that ought to be granted, the modifications ought to be made, and the changes implemented.
Sure.
Doesn't it seem that the court would still have to contend with the authority to do so? And I'm looking at Section 751.12, which people have quoted a part of it. But the opening sentence is, the state Supreme Court shall, by rules promulgated by it from time to time, regulate pleading, practice, and procedure in judicial proceedings in all courts for the purposes of simplifying the same and of promoting the speedy determination of litigation upon its merits. And I'm, you know, the stories and anecdotes we're hearing are very compelling. No reasonable person listening to them can help but be moved by the difficulties that people have faced. But when it comes to this court's authority to modify 973.015, the misdemeanor special disposition, which sets out the terms, and I know you're very well aware of this because you alluded to it in your opening part of your remarks, I'm wrestling with the idea of how the court has the authority to modify the statute if it doesn't run to one of those purposes, simplifying the pleadings practice and procedure, or promoting the speedy determination of litigation upon its merits. Can you help me with that?
I can't help you with the specific reference to that statute. I can help you by indicating that the court currently deals with record retention under Rule 72 as part of its rulemaking.
I know I've heard you made reference to that several times. Doesn't the main point of that seem to be instructions to the clerk of courts as to what they're to do once the statute or a court order instructs them to do it? I mean,
not necessarily. It also...
Well, it says, when required by statute or court order to expunge a court record, the clerk of the court shall do all of the following. And then it lists out.
Right.
To me, when I read that, it seems more like a list of instructions for what the clerk of court needs to do, as opposed to a basis of authority. I'm not trying to necessarily prove a point.
I understand. Mr. Gunther was kind enough to assist me by providing me some answer, or an effort to give you an answer, and it's from in the interest of EC 130 West Second 376, 387 Northwest Second 72.
Sorry, 130 West Second what?
130 West Second 376, 387 Northwest Second 72. That was a case where the court found that the limited statutory expunction remedy was inadequate to do complete justice, and that the court authorized changes, and it cited to Nixon versus Warner Communication as the authority indicating that courts have an inherent authority to control their records and to do justice. There are other provisions of the statute that allow for records to be sealed when there's a showing of a harm to an individual or a life-threatening circumstance. But I must confess that beyond that, I don't have an answer to your question.
And on that, where
I wish I did.
It seems to me a germane part of the question would be whether, in the interest of EC, had a statute that whatever was attempted to be done to have been done with the record might have been in conflict or in supplement to the statute. But anyway, I appreciate that response.
We would be happy to try to find you some authority if we can do that and supplement our materials if you would like to see that.
Do you think your proposal, if accepted, would affect any person's substantive rights? Would it expand them or certainly wouldn't contract them?
I think it would expand people's right to privacy, mm-hmm. their right to liberty and the pursuit of happiness. It's a terrible situation. The worst cases that we ever have as criminal defense lawyers are those who are innocent, because they're the ones who are most difficult to defend, and they're the ones who are harmed most by the fact of a charge. The people who are exonerated are still impacted because of this. Unlike in most states in this country, where there are procedures for people to remove their records when their charges are dismissed or they're acquitted or they're reversed on appeal. And this gives the same authority that Virginia, for example, or California or Texas gives people who are acquitted or exonerated to review. Gives the court, the trial court, the authority to take action in appropriate cases.
Do those states that you just mentioned, do they have statutes that do this, or do they do it by their Supreme Court rules?
I believe both, but I'm not positive on that.
Okay, thank you.
When I looked at that, it was sometimes unclear whether it was a Supreme Court rule or a statutory rule.
Sure. Can I ask you another question? Under the expunction proposal that you have, 7206, sub A is when authorized or required to do so by statute. So that you're really speaking to the current existing expunction statute, right? B, you're talking about record retention periods for those convicted. And is the court supposed to undergo any analysis as to whether it's in the interest of justice or make any other findings when it comes to those people? Or is it just when it's a case that's been dismissed or there's a judgment of acquittal?
Only in the latter would a court have to go through the balancing test. The others would simply track the ultimate disposition of that case in terms of the current retention periods.
So as a judge, when someone makes the motion to me after the retention period has passed, I have to grant their motion? Or what are the considerations?
Under this proposal, that, yeah.
The court record. May, your sub one is a court may order.
It says may,
right.
But
and it's
got to
be on a motion.
Where it talks about the interests of justice or the court making findings about the weighing of society and the harm and the benefit, that's only under the dismissal or acquittal. The other two don't have that balancing. The other two just, and what analysis, if any, does the judge undertake? Or are you just supposed to say, gee, you know, it's been long enough, you served your time, it's been the retention period, so it's expunged. That's part of what I was trying to figure out before from
right.
you.
And I apologize that we didn't think to put the balancing test down below, but I think that
the balancing should go to all three, shouldn't it? I mean, even under the expunction statute, the judge
It's in there. Statutorily, in 973.015, the judge has to go through this identical balancing test. So it should be perhaps in subsection B as well.
Okay, so the real rub where I started today was on B, right? Because that really is an undoing of the expunction statute, which only grants expunction for certain age people and certain crimes and certain time periods and at the time of sentencing. And B changes that to say, doesn't matter how old you are, doesn't matter how old the case is, so long as the retention period has passed. And then you would say you still do some sort of balancing test, right?
Correct.
So B really does conflict with the statute for those who are convicted.
I'm not certain it conflicts with the statute. What it does is changes the retention rules currently. The current retention rules say that if a case starts out as a felony, it's
as long as you don't, at the time of sentencing, you don't make the finding, it doesn't have an age requirement, doesn't have any other requirements. Now, you know, ignore the statute when it comes to B. So long as the retention period's been met, then expunction can be ordered. Right?
That's correct.
So that's a rub with the statute. How, if at all, do any of these intersect with the governor's ability to pardon people?
Currently, as I understand it, if the governor pardons someone, their record remains on CCAMP. There's no entry that I have found that removes the record from CCAMP for someone who is pardoned by the governor. It removes their conviction. It grants them a pardon for whatever, but it still remains on the Circuit Court Access Program. That, again, is a question of the separation of powers and what power the governor would have to deal with court records. That's something that certainly could be considered, but at least in the cases that I'm familiar with, the pardon does not remove it from CCAMP under current rules.
I just wanted to raise one other question with you, which is, cropping up since this morning when Mr. Gunther presented this. As I understand it, this presentation is based on the inherent power of the court. And in what you or others have considered the shared powers area, every once in a while, 751.12 comes up. That statute has been in existence in one form or other since very early statehood days. And it talks about both the legislature and the state working on pleading practice and procedure, and limits the courts in the sense of not changing substantive rights. This proposal
is not brought up under 751.12, as I understand it.
That's correct.
And so we don't have to decide whether it's pleading practice or procedure under 751.12, and don't have to decide if it changes a substantive rule or law or right under 751.12. In terms of power or jurisdiction, if you prefer, the court has to merely decide whether it thinks it falls within the inherent power. If it does, then is it exclusive or is it shared? If it's shared with the legislature, then does adopting this conflict with what the legislature has already done? Might conflict, it might not conflict. I think, yeah, I hear you say it doesn't conflict because it doesn't work in the same areas that the legislature does. Is that right? You're shaking your head.
That's my belief, yes.
But, so I'm trying to keep these lines straight. I see where in the proposal, the you know, we have this new form that people submit when they send in the proposal. And the only, and it talks about the SCR. So the only time it talks about 751.12 is that it has to have proposed effective date July 1. And it says rule change under 751.12 has to have an effective date of January or July. If it's really under inherent power, that provision does not apply. We can have an effective date September 3.
I would argue that that's correct, that that's a correct reading. But when we were submitting this, we were told that there'd been a change, and so we had to conform to that by the clerk's office, as I understand it. Is that? Yeah. And so that's why we referenced that.
Okay. All right. Thank
Mr.
you.
Mr. Maurus, yes. This is probably a question more perhaps directed to Mr. Gunther, but I noticed the opening two lines of the In the Interest of EC case are as follows. The issue in all three cases is whether a circuit court judge in Wisconsin has the inherent or equitable authority to order the expunction of juvenile police records when the delinquency petition resulting from the juvenile's arrest is subsequently dismissed, period. We conclude that circuit courts lack such authority to expunge police records. So while there are some supportive comments, I point particularly to page 388. In regard to Wisconsin court's authority to grant equitable relief, it is said in the most general of statements in one sentence, we agree that a circuit court in Wisconsin has authority to grant equitable relief even in the absence of a statutory right. However, the court went on to hold there was no such inherent power.
Yeah, the EC case dealt with police records, and what the case holding was is that while the courts have authority to control their own records and the access to their own records, which is what Nixon and the EC case deal with, EC tried to go further and deal with police department records. And there are a number of cases that hold that that the court does not have the authority to tell the police what records they shall or shall not keep, nor does it have the authority to tell the Department of Justice what records they shall or shall not keep. We're only dealing with court records here. And the reason that I gave you the cite to the EC case was the language in there which indicates that the court has that authority, but not for the holding of the case, which limited the authority to say you can control your records but not police records.
So it's not, the authority doesn't derive from Supreme Court rule, it doesn't derive from statute, and it doesn't derive from 751 rulemaking authority, so we're left with an equitable authority.
A constitutional power to provide a remedy for a wrong, and equitable authority, and I would submit, yeah, the inherent authority of courts to control their own records. That's what we're talking about, after all, are your records that are created through the court system and their impact on its citizens. That's...
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Yep.
Thank you, Mr. Lowry. Will Williams. Mr. Williams.
Yeah, thank you, Chief Justice and the associates for allowing us the time to express our concerns about this issue. I speak not as one from a legal background, but as one who have been stereotyped throughout life because of laws that this country put forth. And it made me believe that there are only two type of laws. There are good ones and there are bad ones. The bad one I can think of is Plessy versus Ferguson, which created problems throughout the South my entire childhood. I was born in Mississippi, so I grew up under the constricts of that decision that was made in Plessy versus Ferguson, which didn't get repealed, I think, until 1954 under Brown versus Board of Education. I think the CCAP and what's happening, the intent is good for it. But in some instances, there are a lot of bad things that happen. I have a concern about young people, children, students in school. I do counter-recruitment in the schools, trying to keep the military from having so much power over our young people. But when I see where a kid can do something at a very young age, not hardly mature at all, and yet that information can be kept and passed on, not only by CCAP, but people out there who make their money by gathering information and passing it on to people, whether it's employers or whoever, it becomes a problem. Because I don't think any of us in here can truly say that we didn't do something as a kid that was stupid, that at that time nothing happened, but now because of the fear that has been generated since 9/11/2001, a lot of knee-jerk reactions have been made about things that young people do. So we make laws that are very severe, that not only punish people even though they might be not guilty of the offense or even acquitted, but the record follows them and it has an impact that could change their life forever. They wouldn't be able to get the employment they seek simply because of a mistake they did as a child. I had an incident in 1995 where some skinheads came on my property and I got them off the best way I could. An officer came and arrested me, even though I had witnesses there that what this individual said was untrue. So I was brought up on charges of criminal neglect and the use of a weapon. I had a chance to make a plea deal with the district attorney to a lesser charge. They would confiscate my weapon and a $150 fine. I refused because I live by principle. I also refused to get an attorney because I felt that if I had to pay $3,000 or $4,000 for an attorney to go and plea bargain to get me a lesser count, that was the same as me as accepting guilt for something I didn't do in order to escape a punishment that I should not have had. So I didn't get an attorney. I went to court myself and defended myself and won the case. And Judge Fiedler was the judge that I was before. So what I'm saying is that oftentimes we as adults make decisions that we think are good, but the end results are bad. I think of the Truth in Sentencing Law, that has been one-sided ever since it was brought into existence, where it wasn't used the same on all people. And now some actions have begun to take place in the Congress of the U.S. are wavering juveniles into adult courts, sometimes for things that should have been solved at a lesser level. And once the kids get into that program, they are put in a situation where it changes their life forever. Prior moving to Madison, I lived in Chicago and worked with the Department of Corrections Juvenile Division. And I saw young people who had been charged for things that should have been handled in a way different from what they were. And these young people went to institutions where many of them were assaulted, raped, and everything else you can name that happened in institutions. And when they came back, their life was wrecked. And we had problems finding work for them. That was part of my job, was a kind of a rehabilitation program to get them ready for the streets once they came out of the institution. But because of their record, regardless of what it was hard to find placement for them. I remember one kid who had started a fire in a waste can in school when he was 8 years old that ended up in a foster home and later in an institution. And he was assaulted in the correctional facility. So when he came back, he had nothing to look forward to. And I think people, young people now have that problem when anyone can go on CCAP and find out something that happened years ago to use as a reason to deny them employment or whatever. If we lived in a perfect world, it wouldn't be a problem. But I think everyone knows that there are still prejudices out there, not just against people of one color or ethnicity, but because of their class, their standard. That if one have the money, they can afford an attorney that can defend them, that can get expert testimony to come in. But if you're on the lower end of that economic scale, you don't have those things. They're not accessible to you, so you might get locked up for something you didn't do because you can't afford to pay for the defense. So I think it's double jeopardy when a person is charged with a crime and acquitted or found not guilty or any other reason. And yet, when their name go on CCAP, they're able to people able to pull it off and not understand what it did, and it has a negative impact on a person the rest of their life. I know one person here in Madison, I won't call the name, that it happened to. Whatever you do, I hope you look at this in the entirety and don't see it as it being the job of the Supreme Court or the legislature. Regardless of whose job it is to do it, it's something that must be done to protect people and give them the rights that they should have. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Jensen. Any questions? We appreciate your coming.
Pardon?
Williams.
Mr. Williams.
Sorry, you're Mr. Williams. I'm going down to the next person. I apologize to you. I believe the next speaker will be Pat Jansen, resident.
Yes, Patricia Jansen. Justice Abramson, thank you, and honorable member. Oh, I know, I'm too short.
The microphone is too tall.
That's right. Even better. Thank you. I'm honored to be here, first of all. I want to say I am a very transparent person. I have no secrets. My life is open. That's why I don't mind being here. I'm not going to be an anonymous letter in the paper. But for confidentiality, in my letter, the RN nurse and therapist slash minister. I will just refer by them by first names. You have copies of that. I have given you information of everything that I'm going to be speaking of, so you know where I am coming from with this. This all pertains to the state of mind that my daughter is in. I would like to ask you to please consider supporting the state bar petition. I personally have been affected with this, with my name haphazardly being put on CCAP because I have done no wrong, but I am on there. The journey from my husband and I began 30 years ago when we adopted our first child from South America. And our daughter, he was 6 and our daughter was 18 months when we adopted her. This is very emotional for me, so I'll probably read from here. The experiences have not always been predictable or rewarding, but we have gained much wisdom from them. Our daughter, Beth Emily, has been seen by many doctors in the field of psychiatry, psychology, not only in Green Bay and Sturgeon Bay, but also Milwaukee, since she was a very young child. We have been dealing with this since she was, I'd say, 2 years old. She's 27 now. Beth suffers from bipolar, and she's not on any medication because of the relationships with the nurse and the therapist slash minister. They've convinced Beth not to be taking her medication because of the weight gain it gives to her. This has led to the erratic behavior coupled with negative counseling, which led to my name being put on the CCAP. The last 2 years, Beth became entangled with two renegade professionals who are not looking out for her best interests. The first one, Mary, the RN, formerly employed by Bellin Hospital of Green Bay, was asked to leave because of her undermining the doctor's authority. Mary convinced Beth that her previously prescribed psych meds led to her weight gain, and then she stopped her daughter taking these cold turkey. I'm not a doctor, but I know you don't do that. But Beth is an adult. There was nothing we could do. This nurse led Beth to the therapist who had worked for Family Services but lost her license from the professional counseling section of Marriage and Family Therapy, Professional Counseling and Social Work Examining Board of Madison for sexual exploitation by a therapist. So Beth is now living with this therapist slash minister in Green Bay who continues her hypnotic regression therapy safely under the umbrella of her new ministry on 9th Street. Beth continues being indoctrinated further with recovered memories of abuse from her father and I, known as false memory syndrome. The abuse is real in Beth's mind and led her to speak of such to an estimated 300 people gathered at Take Back the Night rally at the Brown County Courthouse grounds on May 1st, 2009. That evening when Beth finished speaking, I approached her in an attempt to stop her saying the lies that she was so blatantly spreading about suffering at the hands of my husband of 42 years and I with satanic ritual abuse. First of all, I don't even know how to do that. When confronted, Beth argued with me before finally leaving, and she was in just a really bad manic state, and I found out later that she had gone to the police station from there and filed a report for domestic abuse against me. Later, I was served a restraining order, a temporary restraining order, much to my horror. I did not know it at the time until days later when informed by a friend that my name was on CCAP. I had not been informed of anything. We had not gone anywhere, no kind of a hearing, but my name was up there. It was then that my husband and I decided to take legal action against Beth, which proved useless except for the $5,498.50 it cost us in legal fees. Judge J.D. McKay, who presided over the hearing, simply dismissed the case and my fact that I was on CCAP, saying it was of no consequence, just go on and live a good life. People will judge you by that. I'm sorry. I don't deserve to be on CCAP. I didn't do anything. I am very involved in Green Bay in the volunteer program. I volunteer tutor in four schools from K all the way up to sixth grade. I go to the middle school. I'm at elementary schools with special needs children. I also tutor out at Sanger Powers, far west side of Green Bay. I'm involved in various prison ministries, church life groups, and I volunteer at St. Norbert College. And my name is up on CCAP for domestic abuse and temporary restraining order. I have that in that folder for you also. With my community involvement, Beth's accusations carry destructive consequences. I used to have a daycare teacher's license. I cannot get a job doing that anymore, not being up on CCAP. I applied for a position in Green Bay working with the elderly. I was not given that job. And not because of what the other man with Mr. Fox said, for another reason, but because they said they cannot have people like me working with an elder. I may be abusing them. I don't abuse anybody. I don't do that. Doors were opened at that point for my tutoring, so I didn't pursue it any further. I was 6 years a daycare teacher, and I still have contact with my children. They are now in high school. I mean, I love children. I do whatever I can to help children. Like I have on here, if I were an employer, I certainly would not hire anyone with restraining orders or domestic abuse in their background to be a caregiver to either age group. Yesterday, the Volunteer Center of Brown County came to school where I was working, and they filmed me working with the children, and they're going to use that as their promo for their volunteer recruitment. I cannot be on CCAP with this. If anybody sees me up there, they're going to say, oh, Pat Chance, oh yeah, she had domestic abuse. And even though it was dismissed, where there's smoke, there's fire, why would my daughter do that to me? Then I have to go through this whole thing. Well, Beth is involved with this therapist, blah, blah, blah. They fueled Beth's victimization. We didn't do anything. And this, with this nurse and with this therapist, I have gone to Jamie Van Hollen. Mr. Detective Darm at Brown County was working with me, the licensing bureau. I mean, I have stacks of paper at home. There's nothing I can do. There's nothing I can do. Beth is an adult. The therapist has no license to lose. She got her ministry license off of the internet. She can do whatever she wants. She's under the guise of the therapist counseling, the ministry counseling. And she's continuing this kind of counseling to everybody else that comes to her church because my daughter keeps bringing her friends there because Mary's wonderful. And Beth is on SSI, and I know that's where most of her money is going, support the ministry. Sunday morning, I got a call from a family friend informing me that this therapist recently and openly spoke of the abuse my husband and I inflicted not only on our daughter now, but also our son, who's 37. We didn't do anything, but now this is her new thing. I'm sorry I'm over my time, but I cannot combat these lies legally. The only thing I can do is continue my quest to have my name cleared from CCAP. When the judge dismissed that so lightly, I thought, this is my life. This is who I am. I cannot be up on there. I cannot. If I was a mother and my child was working with someone and she's up there for domestic abuse or a restraining order, I would think twice about having her work with her. And I work with about 11 children on Tuesdays. Mondays, I work with about 8. And then I work with the offenders that are released out at our church. I'm tutoring. I mean, I'm involved all over Green Bay. And I contacted Mr. Fox when I saw his editorial in the paper. I told him my story, and he didn't want to hear it. He said, you would not be on CCAP if your daughter hadn't done it. He said, you had to have some kind of a court. I forget, I've got his information in there too. And I said, no, this was done before we went to court. We addressed this at court. Our lawyer addressed this at court. And it was just lightly dismissed. That's another story. I can't even go there. I can't prevent my daughter from destroying my life, as she is an adult. Therapist has no license. The nurse now works out of her home, distributing her holistic wares and words of wisdom, making decisions that can alter lives forever. I was dismissed, but I was not erased off of CCAP, and I don't know why. I didn't do anything. Why is that up there?
And
as far as CCAP, we were looking at building a house, and the realtor said, well, go on CCAP and check out the builder. I was shocked when he said that. So I had a laugh when Justice Bradley said that, and I said, I don't go on CCAP. I judge people by how they are and how they act and what, you know, what they do. I don't go on CCAP. And needless to say, we didn't work with him anymore. I have no use for people that go on CCAP. I mean, I'm up there, but... And despite what the papers say about this situation, CCAP does affect people who are innocent. I am one of them. We cannot have contact with our daughter in any way, shape, or form because her mental health issues are such that she's trying to destroy us with the help of this therapist. So I ask you, please do something about people that were dismissed and had done nothing. And I have an assignment for Tuesday from the kids. I have to report everything that went on today and about the justices. So I thank you. I thank you for this chance to come and tell you my story.
Well, we thank you. It's obviously something that's close to your heart and that you've been dealing with for a very long time.
But if people see that up there...
No, I understand exactly how you feel.
And I don't deserve to be up there. So I want to know what you can do to get me off of there. I don't need to be up there. When I went to Sanger Powers, I went through the whole program, and I brought everything with. I'm very open and upfront with this, and Sarah said, Pat, that's a civil matter. We've heard so many things about you that we don't have to worry about that. I was so blessed with that, because I have my tutoring certificate from the Literacy Council, and I told, you know, I love children. I love working with children. That's why we adopted children. But if I went anywhere else and they did a background check, I could not work with children, not with my name being up there. Mm-hmm. So I ask you, please look at this and see what you can do for people that are dismissed. And please do something.
This action of...
Justice Prosser?
This action was filed in May of 2009 and was dismissed when?
He dismissed it.
I mean, right.
He walked out and he said, and because I said to Judge McKee, I said, can't you do something? What about this? Our attorney was arguing, you know, can't you do something? He said, no.
And did you have an attorney?
Yes.
Is that Mr. Anderson?
Mr. Anderson, right. My cousin is an attorney in Green Bay, but was too close to the situation with our daughter and me, so... That wouldn't have cost us anything, but we couldn't have him.
Thank you for your excellent testimony.
Would you please look into this and think what you can do for people like me?
We will consider it carefully.
You have in your CCAP, the court has it in the screen full. It says the court did not issue an injunction against you. The reasons were stated on the record and may be explained in the final order. No adverse inference should be drawn against you when an injunction is denied or a case dismissed. The fact that a petition was originally filed means nothing. That
but
just
it's still
doesn't
up
help.
There.
Still
it doesn't
up there.
Help. I'm still up there. People look at that and say, well, where there's smoke, there's fire. So.
Thank you, Ms. Jensen. Thank you for coming, and
thank you for
giving your story.
To speak to you.
And thank you for compiling this material for the court.
I did it at 1:30 this morning, so I hope it's
fine. It's fine.
Thank you.
Joseph Vaughn, Dads of Wisconsin.
I believe, Your Honor.
I'm sorry. Okay. Doug Venegan. Venenga.
Going this late, I lost most of my audience, huh?
No, you've still got a lot out there in Wisconsin I land.
I'd like to thank you guys. I mean, the playful banter and everything has really made this a lot easier for people that, like me, that don't do this. And
what playful banter?
Playful banter. I just want to tell what happened to me. And, you know, it's kind of going to be the same old story a little bit, I'm sure. But I was married for 18 years, and it was the woman I loved, cherished, and trusted completely. We had three children. We appeared to be a model family. I was my son's scout leader. I did some part-time Sunday school teaching. My wife was on the PTO. She was a Sunday school coordinator. I mean, we, house, dog, you know, three kids. I mean, we had it all going on. And what I didn't know is I was living a life of lies. There was things from our first date that she told me about, past traumatic events of rape and abuse. And that led to even more current lies about medical issues. Our marriage ended when I found out that she'd been cheating. During that time, we were living in the same house until she eventually moved out. On two occasions, once before and once after she moved out, she made false claims to the police. The last time was I invited her over for my then 8-year-old daughter's birthday party, or just a family birthday, I should say. And things were already tense, and it escalated, and without going into all the details, it ended up with me being hauled away. When the police got to the house, I had locked myself in the bathroom to get away from her. And the police got there, and I'm like, oh, good, this helps. Next thing, you know, testifying, you know, getting my statement together, and I'm being taken away in cuffs. I ended up hiring an attorney to fight the charges, and a few $1,000s later, they were dropped. But not because of what my attorney did, it was my wife's divorce attorney that helped the most. She contacted the DA herself and told the DA that their witness, you know, the victim, was not able to tell the truth on many different things, and that included just a history of documented lies, including forging medical records to prove a cancer that didn't exist. So today, I guess I'm here hoping that I can stop dragging around all the dirty laundry that I didn't make. I was the victim. It wasn't her, it was me. I was the victim of years of mental abuse, emotional abuse, and even some physical abuse. And now I feel like I'm a victim of the state. And what happens on CCAP, it does create doubt. I'm a few keystrokes away from somebody running my name and see that Doug Benegay was charged with domestic abuse, and it was dropped. And Justice Prosser made a comment earlier. He said, not all dismissals are equal. And that's true. Some dismissals are plea bargain from people that have actual physical things that they were able to see. The police saw them driving. They did a blood alcohol test and saw they were drunk. I mean, there's actual physical evidence on so many things, and people get those things dropped. I'm in that same category. My charges were dropped. I look guilty as they are. And, you know, that gets kind of hard to deal with at times. Part of it would be if, you know, you guys talk about the truth and the whole truth all the time, and what's left behind isn't the whole truth. It's just such a narrow part of what happened. It just says, charged, dropped. And, you know, that's it. So, yeah, I'm finding some of this really difficult to deal with, and you know, I got this black mark on my character. I'm trying to chisel out a new life, and you know, you go out on a date with somebody, and the first thing you got to try to do is work in a conversation. Oh, by the way, if you look me up on CCAP, you're going to find out that I did this, but I didn't. And you know, I know how it looks. I know how I'd look at it.
Maybe that could wait for the second date, Mr. Benet.
Be a second date. Then.
Yeah, that's a good idea. So, you know, there's a gentleman here from the press earlier, and he made a comment about discrimination doesn't exist from what people see on CCAP. And he said it doesn't exist because there's laws against it. And he implied that people are using CCAP as an excuse, as a crutch to say, I didn't get a job because of CCAP, and not because it's discrimination. But then he went on to talk about it's important to keep these records out there because it helps the media look for racial disparity. That's illegal too, isn't it? But that happens. So his own testimony doesn't add up. You can't have discrimination going on in one place and not going on in another place. I mean, discrimination's in the world we live in. It's unfortunate, but it happens. So, you know, that said, I guess, you know, the other thing, I haven't been in this building since I was a small boy, and I thought it was amazing that I was able to walk in. I spent a lot of time in Waukesha County Court. You know, you go through the metal detectors, and, you know, everybody's right there to check your pockets, and, you know, it's kind of brave what you guys are doing in the post 9/11, and I hope that, you know, this court and, you know, everybody else that works in this building can work together to try to find find the same bravery to stand up against people in the media that think that they have a right to know things that are private. And with that, I guess I'm done unless you have any questions.
Mr. Venenga, the fact that you're here and still smiling is an inspirational matter, and after what you've been through. And no matter, we as a court, we have to wrestle with a number of legal issues. But in no sense or way should any of the questions coming from the bench or any of the comments be interpreted as an indication of a diminishment of the significance and challenges that you and many of the other people have spoken here have been through. So I personally appreciate very much the fact you're here and your good cheer and goodwill.
Thanks. I appreciate that too. And I know that there's a lot of legal issues you guys got to deal with. And I know that there's, you know, people working hard to get this done, and that's encouraging to me. And I guess I just ask that everybody do what you can and try to make this better for, you know, the rest of us, I guess. Thank you.
We appreciate your attitude and your coming, and thank you.
Thanks.
Lisa Andreas, sentencing consultant.
Good afternoon.
Afternoon.
My name is Lisa Andreas, and I'm a sentencing consultant here in Wisconsin. I am too short also. I write reports that the court considers at the time of a sentencing hearing. As a part of the investigative process, I use the CCAP system frequently, and I see firsthand how it affects people. I was not surprised to read in the recent Madison State Journal article that there was some controversy about how many people had actually made formal complaints about CCAP. Frankly, I wouldn't be surprised if there was a low number of these complaints. A simple explanation is that certainly a decent number of these people affected by this process are young, poor, uneducated, being housed in our jails and our prisons. But there are, of course, average citizens that you've heard from today that are also being affected by this. Many of the people that I worked, for example, wouldn't have the first clue how or where to go about making a complaint. On one hand, electronic record access is a relatively inexpensive and non-intrusive way to improve security in our lives. On the other hand, criminal background checks are, in certain circumstances, an invasion of privacy and cause lifetime unwarranted repercussions. When people are arrested, they are frequently charged with offenses that are later dismissed. In some situations, of course, the case itself is dismissed entirely, and in other cases, people are acquitted by a jury. Despite this finding of innocence, this information remains on CCAP and is readily available to the public. Although there are disclaimers on CCAP website stating that any such cases and charges that have been dismissed have no legal effect, it has been in my experience that the defendant is still looked upon negatively because of the CCAP record. According to the U.S. Department of Justice's Bureau of Justice Statistics, in 2007, more than 7.3 million people, or 3.2% of adults, were on probation, in jail, or in prison. The agency estimates that if this trend continues, approximately one in every 15 people will serve time at some point in their lives. There must be a balance regarding the public's access to criminal records, and right now in Wisconsin, there is not a good balance. People have the right to be protected, but people should also have the right to have cases in which they are acquitted or the charges were dismissed, expunged, in order to avoid the prejudice and negative, unfair collateral consequences. Although it was also stated in the same Wisconsin State Journal article that surely citizens who review the records should be able to interpret them properly, this I have also found is not frequently the case. Records compiled on individuals do not always present an accurate picture due to factual inaccuracies, incomplete information, or problems created by examining information out of context. I cannot state the names of my clients in these following pertinent cases due to the confidential nature of my work. However, I can relay the incident in general terms. In the first situation, I was working with a 22-year-old woman who had been convicted of homicide by intoxicated driving. On CCAP, there was a record of another woman with the same name and a similar birth date who had many convictions for drug and alcohol-related crimes. Many of those related to the victim wrote letters to the court and were clearly under the impression that these were the convictions of the current defendant. These letters were understandably angry, but written with the incorrect impression of the facts. In another case, I was working with an 18-year-old woman who had had a restraining order and disorderly conduct charge filed against her as the result of an apartment lease disagreement. The district attorney agreed with the attorney that the charges had no merit, and both the restraining order and the disorderly conduct charge were dismissed. As it stands now, these cases will continue to follow this 18-year-old woman for some time. During recent contact I had with her, she told me that in job and school interviews, she had been questioned about these cases. She said to me, "I feel like I will be defending myself for the rest of my life because of these cases." I have also seen pre-sentence reports written by probation agents and used at sentencing hearings in which dismissed or acquitted charges against the defendant were written about in these reports and in essence used against the defendant in the current unrelated case. I support the petition as presented by the State Bar of Wisconsin regarding reform in the expungement of dismissed and acquitted cases.
You favor this proposal. You favor this proposal?
Yes.
You'd go further?
I'm sorry.
Would you go further in a proposal?
I personally believe that dismissed cases should be destroyed and acquitted cases should be expunged. And I've also heard some discussion today about the retention of cases also. I believe that that is also appropriate.
Thank you. Any other questions? Thank you very much. Carol Rubin. Thank you. Have you submitted anything in writing, Ms. Rubin? No, that's fine. Thank you. Rex, is it Olhoff? Thank you.
Thank you, Supreme Court Justices, for allowing me to speak today. My name is Rex Allen Aloff. I would like to, before I get started in telling you my story, I will try to speak as clear and quickly as I can about this situation. I was mentioned earlier by Marlon Snyder. I am that Rex Aloff. I've been working with Marlon Snyder and Senator Julie Lassa for the last 4 years since my incident has happened with legislative bills to be approached to the assemblies. What I would like to say is when I came here today, I thought of a couple things. First, I'm not against CCAP. I think CCAP is a very good measure with today's electronic age to show the public of a person's guilt by DNA submission or evidence that the person is guilty. I do not strongly believe that CCAP should be used for public to judge a person based on a court record that is very hard for even me to understand when I look back at my CCAP record. So that's my stance on CCAP. I'm here today to support the petition by the State Assembly bill under those measures. During a highly contested divorce starting on October 12th of 2001, ending on September 17th of 2003, on September 26, 2002, at 1:15 at the Columbia Courthouse, I was falsely accused of a crime I did not commit. I was present with my attorney for child placement hearing to seek more time with my then 9-year-old daughter, Paige. What happened on this day has changed my life entirely. During the last two weeks while I was at my home, I found an email by my stepdaughter conversing with her friend about an underage drinking party. My stepdaughter's friend, is the daughter of my friend, the chief of police in Portage. I informed him about the party. The party was busted. The first thing that was said to me when my daughter was brought home from that party was that we will get back at you for ruining our party. On September 26, 2002, attending a child placement hearing while sitting in the hallway with my parents and my friend present with witness my stepdaughter and her friend, the daughter of the chief of police, my then wife and her attorney, all gathered in a huddle. I was asked by my attorney what that's all about, and I asked him, I would like to know the same thing. To my dismay, I was accused 10 minutes before this custody hearing of sexually abusing my stepdaughter 10 years prior to this. After I was told this by my attorney, I walked back out in the hallway and was asked by my ex or wife's attorney, if I left custody the way it is, we would let this all go away. That was told to me later. It was an entrapment measure. If I said yes, I would have been convicted of those crimes. I didn't say yes. I said no. Over the next 6 months, I hired a new attorney to defend my innocence, and this cost my family well over $45,000 to hire this attorney. I know some people in the your justice today spoke about not being able to hire an attorney. I felt like I had to. In February of 2003, I lost my job as a design engineer for Charter Communications. This was one effect of many that has proceeded since this incident. I am proud to say to all of you, the Supreme Court Justice, that on June 23rd of 2003, Honorable James Miller, Columbia County Circuit Court Judge, acquitted all charges, did not even go to a pretrial. Dismissed. On July 15th, 2003, removal of my fingerprint card was expunged from the Criminal Information Bureau record system. On July 2nd, 2003, I requested for my records to be expunged by the State of Wisconsin Justice System, and that was denied. On December 22nd, 2004, at 10 o'clock a.m., a motion was brought in front of Honorable James Miller, Circuit Court Judge at Columbia County, to have my records expunged. That brings me to this moment today. He said to me that he did not have the authority to expunge or remove any record at all under denied or dismissal and acquitted, that I would have to petition the Supreme Court. I'm happy today to be here to petition this request, and I'm asking you to help me with this. One would think after such a trial of overcoming such a troublesome event, you would feel like living again. Today I thought about this. When you're falsely accused of a crime, you are guilty until proven innocent, and that's wrong. The aftermath of being falsely accused of a crime you did not commit has carried on into my life, being on CCAP, and other people have spoke about maybe people not knowing or making up that you did not get a job or whatever. Well, I've had people actually tell me personally that they've overheard people say, that's the person who sexually abused his daughter. I have emails and all this documentation that I will present to the court as well tomorrow, but in the clerk of courts, I'll give this to you. Not all of it, but what you need to see. So there is a stigma that's left on people, and it doesn't go away. It stays with you every day, every night. Since then, I have gone to college, graduated with high honors, trying to rebuild my life. I've worked part-time as a property manager. I know what it's like to do background checks. I personally don't use CCAP. I use tenantscreening.com, those type of source of avenues. I don't think that it's fair to judge a person on a dismissal. An innocent record is innocent. When I was accused of those crimes, I was innocent before I was accused of that. I went through the court system and was proven innocent. That's all I'm asking for, is my innocence to be known back the way it was before my divorce, when all these events took place. I'd like to read a quick article from Peter Fox, who wrote an article in the Portage Daily Register, how much better it is to have complete historical record that shows a charge has been dismissed or found not guilty rather than have a charge appear on CCAP website and then suddenly disappear without explanation. Mr. Fox, my request to you, or response to you, is I want to ask you, the public is not in the business of keeping track of these records. The public is not in the business of judging people. The public should be informed precisely of a person who committed a crime. Period. I know CCAP initiated in April of 1999. Has there been any upgrades to CCAP? I know my Windows 98 is deleted and old. I'm on Windows 7 now. Maybe it's time to look at it. Give it a refreshment. I think a person who designed CCAP would have put in a removal button or a deletion button. With all the talk that's happened here today, I don't see what's so difficult about being able to go in and delete a person's name. If it's dismissed and the person is innocent and acquitted, the same allowance from the stenographer or whoever puts that information in should be able to go in and delete it. I'm a law-abiding citizen. I work hard all my life. All I'm asking for today is some reprieve so I can go out. These are all job applications for 4 years. I can't find a job. I have a college education, 18 years in telecommunications experience, and I cannot find a job. I don't agree with people saying that employers look at that differently. When you're qualified, and I even apply for entry-level jobs, and I hear nothing. In closing, I would just like to ask all of you to consider everybody that has spoken today. It's a very stressful thing to go through, whether you're falsely accused, you're acquitted, facing honorable justices such as yourself, taking time, being away from family members, work, or looking for work, such as I am, to be here today. It's very important to us that our innocence is given back to us. If we abide by the law in the state of Wisconsin, let the law give us back our dignity and innocence. That's all I'm asking for. Thank you very much.
Thank you, sir. Are there any questions or comments? We appreciate that you've taken your time and made the effort to appear.
Thank you very much for listening.
Mary Delaney.
Good afternoon.
Good afternoon, Ms. Delaney.
It's an honor to be before you. I'm a graduate of the University of Wisconsin Law School. As an attorney, I've been working with the Wisconsin Innocence Project to help Wisconsin exonerees connect to needed services, remove their fingerprint and arrest records, and attempt to seal their court case and remove their case information from WCCA, also known as CCAP.
You submitted some material too, ma'am.
In actuality, I believe there was...
But he did from exoneree.
Yes, the Wisconsin, or the, rather the Innocence Project submitted something. Also, Adam Corbett's of the State Bar submitted an article to the Wisconsin lawyer that was...
Thank you.
From Sheila Sullivan and Keith Findlay also.
Good. That's under tab 26 of the justice's material. Thank you.
I understand that you are currently deliberating about whether to modify SCR 72, and I would speak to modifications in SCR 72.06 to include the language to authorize a court to expunge court records in the case of dismissal or acquittal. I urge you to do so on behalf of Wisconsin exonerees who, despite their exonerations, continue to be wrongfully marked as heinous criminals through the perpetual internet publication of their criminal case information. While a student intern at the Wisconsin Innocence Project, I worked on the case of State versus Wisconsin versus Evan M. Zimmerman. Kevin was wrongfully convicted of first-degree intentional homicide in 2001. His case was overturned by the Wisconsin Court of Appeals on August 12, 2003. And in November of 2005, during his retrial, Mr. Zimmerman's case was dismissed with prejudice upon the prosecutor's motion for lack of evidence. Despite his exoneration, Evan was denied a janitorial job on the basis of the case information that his potential employer discovered on CCAP. He left this world in 2007. Cancer devoured him at the age of 61. Until his death, he wore that brand of a murderer that was wrongfully imposed on him by the state. Evan's conviction continued to torment him, despite his exoneration in 2005. He faced discrimination associated with his wrongful conviction for the rest of his life. I'm here today for Evan, and I'm here for the other Wisconsin exonerees who, despite their exonerations, continue to be wrongfully marked. After the release, exonerees continue to struggle to regain standing in the community, and CCAP serves as a formidable barrier to their reintegration. Many of them are so traumatized from their experiences, they can't bring themselves to be here today to speak on their own behalf. I'd like to share with you accounts of two exonerees, Audrey Edmonds and Richard Kittlestad. According to Wisconsin Innocence Projects, Edmonds was a Wanakee daycare provider who was freed in 2008 after the Innocence Project convinced a state court of appeals that scientific advancements since her 1997 conviction in a shaken baby syndrome case raised reasonable doubt about her guilt and the cause of the baby's death. The Dane County prosecutors declined to refile charges. She had spent 10 years and 352 days in prison. She indicates, I, as an exoneree, want to have no criminal record since my charges have been dropped. After having been falsely accused of a crime, no one wants to bring up their criminal record for job employment, housing, leases, home purchases, credit card, job applications, or any other area that asks if one has been charged with a felony. What happened to me and any other exoneree can happen to anyone else. And if it happens to you, you don't want to have to state that you have had a criminal charge. I've had to network a lot in attempting to get a better job. The years of incarceration take away employment skills, IRA contributions, health insurance coverage, vacation time buildup, and more. As an exoneree, I don't want one more red flag to show up when applying for a credit, job, etc. Please pass Bill SCR 72 so we don't have to be confronted with these hurdles anymore. Thank you. Mr. Kittlestad was wrongfully convicted in Eau Claire County in 2001. He indicates that I was a parish pastor prior to my conviction for soliciting prosecution with four Panamanians I brought to this country. The charges were bogus. They were the product of four desperate young men who did not want to return to Panama. They supported their allegations by creating an audio tape, which was later proven beyond doubt to be edited by using four or five separate conversations. The Innocence Project brought my case to the State Appeals Court, which dismissed it. You ask how having this wrongful conviction posted on CCAP has affected my life. When I was first released, I was denied reemployment at Kohl's department store after a background check. I was refused access to public housing because of my record. I was told by my bishop that it would be very difficult for me to serve another congregation because of this cloud hanging over me. Various landlords in Eau Claire, when I was first released, did not call me back after I submitted applications. I presume they did their own computer check. I don't even attempt to get a job teaching or substituting because of any curious kid with a computer could quickly learn of my legal history and trash my reputation. For the same reason, I hesitate to becoming a formal member of a congregation, preferring to be nameless, a nameless visitor in a pew. I find myself even now finding ways to avoid giving out my name to prevent other people from learning about me. It's a terrible thing to be afraid to meet new people or be ashamed to use your own name. The whole episode has left me alienated, bitter, and depressed. I feel the need to help others so something like this does not scar their lives, but I also feel the desire to run away from it all, bury myself so it cannot touch my life anymore. I see most of our exonerees traumatized and suffering from what they have been forced to endure as a result of their wrongful convictions. They continue to suffer because CCAP stands as a formidable barrier to their reintegration to their community. Nationwide, there is a growing recognition that people who have been wrongfully convicted continue to suffer enormously after their conviction has been overturned. In fact, in Maine, the courts have concluded that as a matter of law, people who are wrongfully convicted are victims of the crimes. Changes are being made state by state. In more than three-quarters of the states, there's some provision for expunging, sealing, or otherwise limiting access on non-conviction case information. Here in Wisconsin, there also seems to be some understanding that there is a stigma attached to prior convictions. We do expunge certain cases of authentic convictions for first-time offenders in order to give people a second chance at livelihood. Why not afford that same opportunity to those people who are authentically blameless? Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Delaney. How many people have come through the Innocence Project now that have been acquitted or not re-prosecuted?
Upwards of 20 people, I believe, some
in Wisconsin.
In Wisconsin specifically. There have been motions made by the members of the Wisconsin Innocence Project in multiple counties for a removal of this case information, for sealing of records and removal of information from CCAP, and they have had very limited success.
Mm-hmm. Justice Prosser.
Could you please define what an exoneree is?
Well, in these instances, there have been cases that have been dismissed. More often, they're overturned. Oftentimes, it's through the Court of Appeals. And it does propose a particular problem because a lot of that information, of course, is not cross-referenced with Wisconsin Circuit Court Access Program. So all that information with respect to the case being overturned and so on and so forth does not appear there on the WCCA, so it makes things even more convoluted for these individuals.
I assume that the people who have been convicted, is that right?
Yes, most often initially they are convicted and their cases are overturned.
They're overturned.
Well, just for purposes of analysis here, are you familiar with the case of Ralph Armstrong?
I have some understanding, but I'm not completely clear about that particular case. I'm not well-versed in that particular circumstance.
Well, his conviction was ultimately reversed. He was not retried. The case was dismissed. I mean, does he qualify under your definition of an exoneree?
Again, I can't speak to that specific case. I'm not familiar enough with the circumstances or the basis under which that particular case was overturned. If he was not retried, I presume that he would qualify in terms of our definition of exoneree. I believe that he would probably qualify for to have his case expunged under this proposal, if I'm understanding the circumstances of the case correctly.
Well, I'm not so sure about that because it goes to, yes, you're right, it's not limited to felony or misdemeanor if there's been a dismissal.
Of course, that would be up to the judge who presided over that particular case to make that determination about the other balance of public right versus private interest and also societal interest. Private safety and so on.
I think he's in prison in another state.
That was what I last understood. There was some kind of violation of a parole.
Right. That's my understanding. I don't remember what state, but my understanding. And I only know that because I read it in the newspaper.
And that's about my understanding of the matter as well as what I picked up from the newspaper.
I think the dilemma the court is facing, in part, we have heard testimony here of people who, in all probability, if you accept what they've said, are totally innocent of ever committing an offense. There are other people, some of whom testified here today, at least one person who I would say you couldn't believe a word that person said. And there has to be some rational way to distinguish one from the other.
It's very difficult, I imagine. I think that that is probably why the balancing test is suggested in this instance, and that there is a consideration of a necessary and the appropriateness of the expunction provision as it would be applied to any particular case, because there is such a variation in the factual situations behind every dismissal or acquittal.
Are there any other questions or comments? Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Delaney. Fred Saker, is it? Saker? Saker.
Thank you. It's good to be here this afternoon. Thank you for hearing me.
Thank you for coming, sir.
In 1989, I was arrested and tried for a brutal rape and kidnapping and burglary that I did not commit. I was sentenced to 15 years. I served 7 of those years, and then I was exonerated, as we were just discussing. Justice Prosser, I can define for you what exonerated is. That's, in my case, the charges were dropped because at that time I was exonerated because of DNA evidence. But the district attorney still wanted to prosecute me. And he continued to try to do that, but through the efforts of my attorney and what he says, what the victim did not want to go through another trial, the case was dropped and all the charges were dismissed. And that is when I became an exoneree.
I assume you moved to open your conviction as a result of the DNA evidence.
The case was just overturned, eventually, when I went in front of the claims board. But that was as far as it went. The case was just dismissed, and it was dropped, and that was the end of it. And there was, nobody said they were sorry. They just said, we don't want to prosecute you. You've served enough time anyway, and we don't want to put the victim through that. I was able to get my fingerprints removed or expunged. I was able to get the DNA evidence removed from the data bank, but I have never been able to get this to go away. There's 4 pages of information on CCAP, and that's why I'm here today. Is because I feel that I've been victimized enough by the 7 years that I served, and that I shouldn't continue to be victimized by the information that appears on CCAP. And I think my story just more mimics everybody that has presented testimonies here today. So I won't continue to with a lot of details about it, but I just don't feel that it's right, for the sake of transparency, that all of us that have presented testimonies in here today should be victimized. I mean, there's a dozen people here, and how many more are there that weren't aware of this hearing? And why should they continue to be victimized just so this system, this inaccurate system, can exist? If people want to have access to records like this, then they should be accurate. And everything possible should be done to make those records accurate.
Is your record inaccurate, or is it that it just is accurate, but people misread it? I mean, I don't have it in front of me.
I haven't investigated it fully, but there's 4 pages of all the procedural court proceedings, and at the end, in very small print, it says dismissed. But that doesn't mean that people couldn't look at this, and there's case numbers on here and so forth. It's available to anyone, and I don't think that information should be available to just anyone who wants to look it up. Not in my case. And I hope you're sympathetic to that. And I thank you for your time.
Thank you. Are there any questions?
Well, incidentally, not only was my case dismissed, I did go before the Wisconsin Claims Board, and it was actually overturned, and I was found innocent of all charges, and I did receive the minimum compensation, which, incidentally, that statute needs some attention, too.
Thank you.
May
yes,
I ask?
Justice Prosser.
You have the text of the proposed rule.
I've read it, yeah.
And do you believe this rule as it is worded now would be able to reach your CCAP entry?
Right now, I don't know of any mechanism or avenue that I can explore that's going to, other than being here today, that's going to get my information removed from CCAP. So according to what I read in the revision of that statute, that there would be an avenue to getting my records expunged. Now, it would, again, depend upon the court's ruling, I take it. Which I wouldn't be too afraid that they wouldn't rule in my favor, given the DNA evidence and the other the court ruling by the claims board to support my case. I would think that it would be ruled in my favor. So I think that's an improvement. I would look towards something more automatic, that once my conviction has been overturned or I am expunged or I am exonerated, that my records should be expunged. That would be my...
And you are correct. That is not the way this now reads, and you would have to go back to a trial court. And
but at least there's some mechanism there to do it. And right now I don't know of anything that exists. And Rex is up against the same wall.
Have you tried to get the judge to expunge?
I have looked into it, and I've had Mary Delaney look into it, and I've had the Innocence Project look into it, and they are much more knowledgeable about it than I am. I don't have the legal background, and they cannot find any avenue to explore to get this done. We're possibly looking into some other things right now.
Thank you. Anything else? Thank you very much
Thank
for
you.
Sharing your thoughts with us today. We appreciate your coming.
Thank you for your time.
Sheila Sullivan, Legal Action of Wisconsin. It's been a long day for you.
It was still afternoon, and I got a ticket, so
bad combo. We'll be on CCAP.
Civil? I don't believe so.
Okay, well, I don't know how many you have.
I'm honored to be here today, Chief Justice, and I'm pleased that the Supreme Court is considering petition 0907. So many things have already been said. I don't want to trump over a lot of ground that has been lightly or heavily trod. I submitted comments late, and I assume that you will get them. They address in part the specific issues. Fred Sager and some of the other people have seen sort of the high dramatic effects of their encounters with the criminal justice system. I'm an attorney for Legal Action of Wisconsin in Milwaukee. In our office, we see what you might call the low drama effects of interactions with the civil and criminal justice system. Patterns of people who have low-level encounters, lots and lots of arrests, maybe a few convictions, lots and lots of filed evictions that are later dismissed. And what I see is the kind of cumulative stigmatizing effect of that on people's capacity to enter fully into the kind of citizenship and the kind of economic freedom that we expect in this society. I talk about it more. I don't think I want to talk about it here today, but I do talk about it some in my comments because I think it's worth noting. There's a long and well-established history of racial disparity in relation to arrest records. Any system that continues to carry and publish dismissals and acquittals will probably also carry out and continue to magnify the effect of that racial disparity. And I think that's important to consider when we're talking about the economic viability of certain parts of the population. Other vulnerable groups will particularly also show this pattern. For example, if you're homeless, you tend to have, in the period of time of homelessness, a pattern of arrests associated with homelessness. Public urination, trespassing, loitering. And so those arrests create, particularly through the mechanism of WCCA, create a kind of aura of criminalization that doesn't require conviction for a crime. It makes you an unstable person, a risk, etc. We can talk about that a little bit more. I would like to respond to a couple of issues that have been raised by people sort of repeatedly, and I think they've become like mantras. One is, well, if things aren't on WCCA, somehow there'll be a vacuum and it'll be rushed, filled with sort of even worse information or more unreliable information. I know that you probably all know this, I'm sure you do, but I would remind everyone that third-party data vendors that sell criminal and other court records are governed by FCRA, Fair Credit Reporting Act. They're governed by federal law. They are credit reporting agencies for the purpose of federal law, and they have reporting requirements. They are, in fact, regulated. Incorrect information can be corrected on those reports. So it's not as if there's sort of there's a huge information industry, but it's not entirely regulated. So a change made in the CCAP system, or a change that affects how data is given out to the general public in this state, will not necessarily put people in a worse situation. In fact, I would argue it would clearly put them in a better situation.
What people are you talking about? Which people are going to be in a better situation?
The people who are the section of this petition that applies to dismissed, and we're particularly concerned with dismissed and dismissals and acquittals. And we are concerned as well with civil dismissals, particularly in the area of evictions. Because if any of you have been paying attention, there's been a tremendous amount of research recently about evictions in Milwaukee and the effects of evictions on poverty, rates of female poverty, and the quite common use of dismissed evictions as codes for troublesome tenants who won't get rented to again. And as an organization that defends people against eviction actions, we recognize there are a huge range of reasons why evictions are dismissed. I would also like to say something briefly, although there are probably people with more experience than I who have spoken to this question, about the authority that this court has to fashion some kind of solution for this problem. It's clear that the legislature has spoken, and by specifically addressing the question of expungement of criminal convictions, has modified this court's equitable authority to deal with that situation. Also my understanding that legislature cannot modify a court's inherent authority, because that is in fact a violation of separation of powers. There are solutions to some of the problems that are raised by the position that don't even need to go as far as full-scale expungement or expunction of records. CCAP has already crafted a solution that they use in cases of mistaken identity, which all of you are aware of, that the case is searchable only through a case number and the name John or Jane Doe appears on the record. For many of my clients, that solution which would leave the full record on CCAP available, all the historical interest in the events themselves. The single thing that's taken out of the equation is the stigmatizing effect of linking those events to a particular person. That's really the solution, the smallest level solution that would serve a tremendous number of the people that have spoken here today. I see no issue of authority in any way, shape, or form. Courts are clearly allowed to seal or control certain parts of a court record. I also wanted to say one other thing, since it's come up in multiple discussions of this issue. People talked about how CCAP records could be used for the public good, which I think is tremendously important, WCCA, and I support openness of records, but multiple times I've been told that you can track prosecutorial decisions through WCCA. So I called the information gurus at WCCA, who told me, no, that's absolutely impossible. You can't track anything through the system by the name of a prosecutor. The only way you can track information in the system right now is by the name of an individual party. You just need to do, I guess I'd call it good, hard investigation or something else to make those decisions. So I'd just like to say, for the sake of truth in advertising, it's not true, as far as I can tell. That's all I have to say today. I think this is a really important issue, and it was profoundly moving for me to hear all the people that came here today to talk about it.
Are you suggesting that, and you're the first one I think that's brought this up, that one avenue the court might take is for those people who had charges dismissed or were acquitted of the charges, that the court somehow authorize the name being changed publicly to John Doe or Jane Doe, and then perhaps an internal record by way of the case number?
Yes, Justice Rogozak, yes. That seems to me the simplest solution to a huge set of problems. It doesn't disturb the record. It's available in both electronic and state form. Mm-hmm. What it does is take the piece of information that is least important in public records or a constitutional setting, the name of the particular individual who wasn't convicted, who wasn't found guilty, who wasn't evicted.
Thank you.
Query whether there are other parts that have to be redacted, though.
I believe back to the question that was brought up. I mean, there are solutions that don't rise to the level or fall to expungement in this state has a particular meaning. Sealing, redaction, all of those are clearly within both the supervisory and the inherent powers of this court.
But let me ask.
Justice Bruss.
Let us say someone is charged with an offense and is acquitted, found not guilty in a jury trial. Do you think there should be some automatic remedy that flows from that?
I don't believe it's in this petition. In my heart and my sense of rightness as a lawyer, yes, I do. If you are acquitted, you are, in Wisconsin law, innocent. It doesn't... I think the provision should be, I see difficulties in creating a full-scale hearing system. I understand that may be, if we're talking about small steps, what is required. But I guess I'm amazed the passion this brings. For years, I haven't been a lawyer for years, but for years, clearly, the Department of Justice and the Crime Information Bureau has altered their composite electronic records by taking records of arrests that do not lead to conviction off their records. If I want to do a regular crime information background check, I get only that redacted record. No one has had any problem with that. It's done automatically. Fill out fingerprint forms, send it to the Department of Justice. No one has any problem with that. So part of me wants to say, well, I mean, again, the underlying records will all exist as they exist in the case of, there are police and arrest records. There are court records. I don't know why it's different. as someone who has a strong historical background, I don't like taking narrative to the extent that CCAP is narrative. Case events are important, and the history of case events are important. That part seems to me there's some real public value in preserving. But the name of the person who happened to be embroiled in that, I'm not sure. I understand, I think, that this proposal, that this petition recognizes circuit court's desire to have continuing authority over this. But we do it automatically in another context.
Thank you very much. Now, your office handles civil cases, and you get these because someone comes in with a complaint on landlord-tenant or credit, and then it...
Correct. A lot of our business now is dealing with the correction and matching up of records themselves, which is a problem. I have clients who are trying to get jobs doing census work. That requires now they do the initial screening check through the FBI. If their records here don't match up, we have to provide original court dispositions to try to make all the records match up. This is, managing records is a complicated business now for people when they're looking for employment. And part of trying to move towards a more simplified system is the degree to which all corrections, all efforts to get your reputation back are always the responsibility of the person. So you have Mr. Saker here who's had a conviction overturned. He's not been prosecuted. He's gone to the claims board who found him innocent, and now he's going to have to go back to another court to prove that he's innocent enough to deserve to get his name hidden from public view. That seems to me, there's something profoundly wrong about that, it seems to me.
I just wanted to clarify how you get into this. But that's through that system.
Right. That's how I get into it, because I can't actually deal with the crime and just the civil problems arising from it. Thank you very much.
Standing. Thank you very much, Ms. Sullivan. David Hoppe, who's been here since 8:45, if not earlier.
I thank you for being here. Let's hear a really good judge story, first of all, a really compliment, because many judges really deserve it. David Flanagan, judge.
Yep.
Recently he had a ruling on behalf of a troubled young man in a school, and Mr. Judge Flanagan said, no, we're not going to put you out and throw you on the street and let you there to rot. I am going to insist that you receive an education. And I applaud him from the bottom of my heart. It's about time. We can't just take some of these younger people and throw them in a landfill and let them there. Folks, it's too expensive. We don't have that kind of money for the institutionalization of many, many, many of these people. And Judge Flanagan, just hats off. We need to evaluate some of these situations more thoroughly and perhaps help them to go to a charter school where they can learn uniquely and learn differently than they've been able to do before. My second hats off, Alderman Assemblyman Schneider, while being absolutely, the assault on him in the press was unconscionable. I just can't imagine such a personal attack. But the message is out. Many people care about this. And Marlon, I just think this is so great. I'm not appearing tonight on behalf of myself. I'm appearing on behalf of others. I've been an alcohol drug counselor, an at-risk teacher, a guidance counselor. One of my best was careers teacher. And you talk about we need to do something to help these people. We cannot give them a life sentence who have been troubled. That world of work I'm going to pick on almost up to age 25. Because I did night school many years, and almost every person in night school had a lot of issues, the biggest being poverty. They had to work. But As a careers teacher, so many people, that job was their life. How many students did I have that I didn't see smile for 2 and 3 years? And you get them a job, as I went out to many, many, many employers, and would you take this person? This kid had a new life. It was so inspirational and so encouraging to be part of that process. That career was their world. Gainful employment. They didn't have to be dependent on their parents. And I'm going to reveal this. I worked in Madison East for the bulk of my career. And yes, we were 50 to 60% free and reduced lunch. And we had a lot of kids with a lot of issues. Where's dad? Where's mom? Severe learning problems. Emotional abuse, distress. And this is the population now that is on CCAP. Can they be an advocate for themselves? I got another eyeful, Equal Opportunities Commission. I spent time there at the Job Center, Bethel Lutheran Church. And what was the fourth? Oh, MATC with some of the Huber people there. And just the stories you hear are astounding. So I'm primarily here as an advocate for people under age 25. If any of you are parents, I'll bet you've had eras that you didn't even want your kid to come home, and someday your kid came home, and someday you stayed up all night, and they were a different person at 15 than they were at 17, or vice versa. The tremendous amount of adolescent changes are very, very responsible for a lot of their behavior. I don't know how many times I witnessed fights in the cafeteria. You know what most of the fights were about? The same thing you hear about and we see in the paper every day. They were about love triangles and relationships. This is my girlfriend. This is my boyfriend. And all of a sudden there's a fight. And a couple fists start throwing. And there's a black eye or two. The records have to be just enormous, the number of fights in school. Regrettably, many of the students need to learn a lesson and never did. I wish I could have told them as a careers teacher, but when the police come in, shut your mouth. Agree. Don't go cock it off to the police coming in. Don't be insubordinate. Don't be a jerk. Don't argue, yell, and scream. This is an officer. And if you're fighting between another person and an officer gets kind of in the middle, stay away. Because now you don't have one charge. Now you have 3 or 4 charges, and you have big-time felonies. They made mistakes. I feel bad. The other day I was out, I saw one of my former students at an East Washington place. I don't want to name the place. I said, how are you doing? And he said, well, not a whole lot has changed. He said, I just really never wanted to be here my whole life. I said, well, what did you really want to be? He said, I always wanted to work in a bank. He always wanted to work in a bank. What happened? Well, I'm on CCAP, and I can't get another job, and I could never be a CPA because it's going to affect my license. And I could never get a job because it's CPA. There's going to be standards, and some of these things are maybe fact, but some are fiction. I have careers in real estate. I have help desk, which a lot of people could do. The substantial relationship issue is really severe. Because many of these jobs the kids are denied for because of CCAP, there's no substantial relation to the actual duties they would be doing. There's none. And student after student, my last couple of weeks out at these places, more at the job center, said, you know, this is just a kiss of death. for me. I'll never get a chance. I can't get a license. I can't be a teacher. I can't work in a health profession. And many of the students have served their dues. Also, hats off to the many, many people that have straightened the life out and have done so many brilliant, wonderful. They've grown up. They're no longer a punky little jerk. They've grown up. They have a child. They have a wife. They're a different person than they were. Why do we need to continue to penalize them for the rest of their life? Probably two-thirds of the people in this chamber today smoke pot. How does that affect many, 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 many careers? And it's on the record? So I think we have to be, you know, very careful in terms of what you're doing. I made a few changes here, a few suggestions. Expunge records after 3 years. And I used the age of 25. And you know automobile companies, you know what they do to teenagers? They rate them because there's a lot more risk. And actuarial people are no dummies, and I have tremendous respect for the School of Business and the actuarial and business community. I'm a business major. After you get to be 25, they lower the rates because you're not going to do all these crazy things anymore. It's kind of like a grace period or releasing somebody. And a couple of our speakers today mentioned this. Review and give some consideration to community service, extensive community service. We had a couple speakers that mentioned that. Charge a fee for all people who want to access CCAP. You know, it's funny, CCAP can get everything in the world about you, but you can't do any discrimination, nor do kids have any resources or young adults. They don't know how to fill out this paperwork. They don't know how to get an attorney. They don't know how to jot down every little thing and get their record. So they can't find out who checked on them. How can they possibly say I was discriminated against? They have no way to ever know this. And the worst person after person, especially like 22, 23, 24, tells me the worst and hardest places to get jobs are corporations because their home office and their corporate has all these little rules. We don't know about any of these rules. Here's another one. Provide incentives for people who do want to straighten out. If you get a degree, a diploma, a vocational trail, a skill, you can be gainfully employed. Give the people some incentive who goes through those measures to improve themselves so you don't have to pay for their property taxes, their welfare, their medical insurance for the rest of your life. Let them stand on their own 2 feet. Give them a little carrot there. They need it. It is the right thing to do.
Mr. Hoppe?
Am I done?
Oh.
Sorry.
That's okay.
I won't read the rest of the career if you have to get a license for it.
All right. No, thank
questions?
You.
No, I'm sorry. This is obviously near and dear.
It is. And I wasn't joking because when I got in today, you were already standing in the hall waiting and have been very patient and have told us about your experiences and your wishes for these kids, and that's important. Thank you.
Trying.
Stephen Blake, Dads of Wisconsin.
I'm not nearly as loud. I understand his enthusiasm as a teacher.
You've been waiting a long time.
Okay. Chief Justice Abramson and Associate Justices, I appreciate the opportunity to address this court. And I also appreciate your patience and your attentiveness to not only your colleagues on the bar, but to the lay people who have testified here today. I wish that some of the other representatives, the other branches of government in this building, were as respectful to the citizens that they serve. My testimony today is going to be exclusively about CCAP because expunction and retention of records and that sort of thing is beyond my pay grade. My name is Steve Blake, and I represent the organization known as Dads of Wisconsin. Dads of Wisconsin represents fathers who have lost all or some of their rights to raise their children through action to the family courts here in Wisconsin. The reason we are concerned with proposed reforms is that many of our people have been falsely accused of crimes such as domestic violence, child abuse, or sexual abuse. It has been noted that allegations of domestic violence tend to cluster around partners with children and no prior history of violence. Many believe that such domestic violence allegations are made to gain a legal advantage during a divorce proceeding. With remarkable candor, one legal expert advised, with child abuse and spouse abuse, you don't have to prove anything, you just have to accuse. A 2005 article in the Illinois Bar Association notes that allegations of abuse and restraining orders are often used as part of the gamesmanship of divorce. An example here in Wisconsin just this week illustrates what I'm talking about. In the Wisconsin State Journal, February 16th issue, a story detailed how a 25-year-old woman stabbed herself in the palm with a knife and then falsely accused a male acquaintance of attacking her. The man was arrested and charged with two felonies before authorities dropped the charges. Yet those serious charges still appear on CCAP. In spite of the disclaimers on CCAP, too many people either do not understand the concept of innocent until proven guilty or don't really believe in it. The mere appearance of charges leads as many to think that where there's smoke, there's fire, or they didn't do anything wrong, they wouldn't have been arrested. Dads of Wisconsin believes it's bad enough that false allegations so frequently occur, let alone that one should have to carry the scarlet letter of an unproven allegation available to anyone who chooses to simply pull up a web page. We strongly support these proposed reforms. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Blake. Did you submit a writing? Just, I'm trying to keep...
Yes, Your Honor, I did.
Good, thank you. It must be in this pack that we got today. Thank you. Any questions? No. Thank you. Paul Whitmer. Mr. Whitmer. Marion Friedel is not going to be here. Dale Merrick is here.
Excuse me, can you say his name again? It's not on my list.
Me?
His name is not on my list. Dale.
He was given to me. Dale Merrick.
Merrick.
M-A-R-E-K.
Thank you very much.
And you're listed as a resident.
Yes. I have to apologize to some of the speakers before I start, especially you, because your poignant story is going to make what I have to say probably seem pretty self-serving and selfish. But I have to represent an aspect of society and perhaps a different voice that you haven't heard yet today. My name is Dale Merrick. I live in Milwaukee. I'm 55 years old. In 1994, I was convicted of three felony counts, for which I still maintain my innocence. I served 5 years in prison. In 1999, I began to serve 4 years of supervision. And in 2002, my case was suggested to be reversed by the U.S. Magistrate Aaron Goodstein, and Chief Staff Miller disagreed with it, so I remain with the convictions today. In 2003, I was blackmailed by a friend who had admitted under oath that he was extorting me, but yet based solely on his testimony, I was revoked for 4 years, spent an additional 4 years in prison. So I can say that my convictions do remain right now, but they're tenuous at best. Except for a brief time in 2000, I've not worked since 1994, nor did I pay taxes, and I've given up on applying for jobs. I've been diagnosed with depression. I live at home with my mother. Badger Care supplies my health care for me. It pays for my medications, my hospitalizations, my doctor visits. And in 2008, I tried to break out of this rut, and I started a small business. I'm a singer, and I put a 16-piece band, big band behind me. I had one musician I had, a saxophone player, that I had a disagreement musically with. And the next rehearsal, my rehearsal hall was empty. And my 16 musicians were at another hall. The saxophone player looked up my record in CCAP, and as I understood it, they were at the next hall reading transcript, my transcript. I lost my band. I lost my business. The next morning, I was admitted to Frederick Hospital for a stress-related heart attack. And now, in hours of depression or in despondency, I have friends that are also convicted felons, and we ruminate about which country we could flee to that we might seek asylum or refuge so that we could get on with our lives. The people who need it most, the employment, the housing, the community, are convicted felons. When released, felons can't find jobs. It undermines their reintegration into society. CCAP is punitive. It continues to punish and imprison long after a person's discharge. It takes an emotional and psychological toll on these vulnerable citizens of our state. And it's a base of citizens that are growing larger every day. And it represents a group of people and circumstances I think that none of you can appreciate. And SORP are wonderful and needed tools for the prosecution and law enforcement, but for the public, it is voyeuristic and merely salacious. CCAP is inherently corrupt in that when an employer or landlord abuses it, discriminates, you'll never know about it. No one will admit to it, and there's nothing no one can do about it. If we're going to revisit George Orwell, do you want a vision of the future? Imagine a boot stamping on a human face forever.
Thank you, Mr. Merrick. Does anyone have any questions or comments? We appreciate your coming today, spending time here, sharing your story and your grief with us.
Thank you.
That concludes my list. Is there anyone here who wishes to speak? Just 1 minute. Is there anyone else who would like to speak? Sir, just come to the microphone.
Thank you for letting me ask this question. I forgot to ask you, during the proceedings today, I was overhearing all the things that have been brought up. One thing that sticks out the most to me is I'm very unclear, is the record expunged from a youth up to the age of 25?
That is under a statute, and I think you should talk to Mr. Morris about that. Do you mind? He'll talk to you about the language of the statute.
If I could comment, if that allowance is given to a youth, if a person, myself, 45 years old, trying to establish life as well, I should be given the same allowance at any age.
We understand that argument, but it was legislative, and that's what it is.
Okay. I was just unclear of that.
Thank you, but Mr. Morris will go through that with you. Is there anyone else who would like to comment? If not, I'm going to turn, as I had said I would, to Mr. Gunther. Mr. Gunther, you started the proceedings. You've heard probably 27 or so people speaking for and against your proposal that has come to us from the State Bar. What are your concluding comments?
Thank you, Your Honor. First, this court has the authority to regulate access to its own records. In response to Justice Rogensack's question, I don't believe that this would abridge, enlarge, or modify any substantive right. This authority exists and is documented by the very existence of Chapter 72. Right now we look at how long we retain records. And the U.S. Supreme Court has adopted in Warner Communications versus Nixon that the authority exists. Justice Prosser, in particular, you had questions as to the contours of that. In a case where there are multiple charges but any conviction exists, even a misdemeanor, our petition would have no effect on existing law. If it were dismissed after someone's conviction was reversed by the Court of Appeals or by this court, then they would be eligible to go before a trial court judge and ask for that balancing test to be applied. If an individual has a single read-in charge, we're talking about complete case files. So a dismissed but read-in charge is one for which they agree to accept responsibility, and it is not an outright dismissal, and would not have any, our petition would have no effect on that. There was comment that there isn't a problem. We heard about a problem today. I would direct this court to pages 12 and 13 of the petition. There are studies that document this problem. Professor Pager's work included studies in Milwaukee, and in essence, the conclusion is mere contact with the criminal justice system, even when there is a dismissal or an acquittal in a letter from a judge saying that this person's presumed innocent, still has a negative consequence in employment. Right now, 40 states, by either legislative action or court action, provide for sealing of court records or expunction in circumstances in which there was no conviction entered. And here, yes,
Sullivan brought up something that I hadn't been aware of before, or a suggestion I hadn't been aware of, and that is when someone is acquitted or the charges are dismissed, there could be an automatic provision into CCAP that their name comes out and John Doe or Jane Doe goes in. Would that meet your needs?
Your Honor, this is an issue that's been worked on, I believe, with the legislature while I was still a law student. And any movement to protect folks who retain the presumption of innocence would be a big step and would be appreciated.
It meet your needs? I'm just trying to see if whether her suggestion satisfies what you're concerned about.
I think in the large it would. It's not what I've charged to present before the state.
I understand that. Thank you.
This was raised by Peter Fox, who I think was the first person in. Justice Prosser asked if there were any other techniques and means. And we went back to the concept that it could be done through CCAP and raised in a number of other instances. I don't know if you were here all the time when that was done.
Other than lunch, I was, yes.
Okay. It doesn't resolve several of your issues. It doesn't resolve retention. That's 72.015, which you would decrease, if I understand.
It would be looking at the final disposition of the case.
That's right. It might or might not resolve 72, all of your 72 on expunction is now handled by the trial court.
Correct. Again, the proposal that was made isn't a bad one, and it's something I think the State Bar would favor. It's not the extent to which the State Bar is asking. There was a notion made that this would somehow be a secret court or not promote openness. How this would function is no different than what courts do now under 973.015. I worked in Afghanistan to advance their justice system. I can tell you what a secret court would look like if you'd like to know, but that's not what we're talking about here. This is the same thing that the legislature passed and within the court's inherent and equitable authority. Right now we have a system. There was some allusions to our high school literature classes, and one of them was the Scarlet Letter. Hester Prynne was branded with the Scarlet Letter and committed the act of adultery. Right now, the legislature's created a vehicle for those who have committed criminal acts, including some felonies, to have the records expunged. What we're talking about is the brand of the CF or the CM for folks who have committed no offense. CCAP is used by some people as an offender registry without regard to whether charges were proven, whether there was a conviction, or whether these are folks who were acquitted. And that's the action for which this court has authority, as stated by the U.S. Supreme Court, as stated by the very existence of the current Rule 72, and which equitable authority provides to do complete justice. The State Bar asks you to do complete justice here. I thank you very much. I know we've had a long day.
Well, our day's not done. Mr. Gunther, I want to, on behalf of the court, thank you for spending the long day with us here, and thank the Individual Rights and Responsibilities section of the State Bar for taking this through the State Bar and through the court system today. It's obviously an issue that affects a lot of people, people who may already be down and out for any number of reasons, and very important, and very important also for the court system and for the whole concept of our government being an open government.
It is. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you, Mr. Gunther. That completes our hearing on 09-07, and it's a mere 4:25, so the court will has approximately one more hour, and we will come out and see what we can do in our administrative conference. Thank you all for appearing.